You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Lawrence Shoup. Lawrence is the author of a new book about the Council on Foreign Relations. He was the co-author in 1977 of Imperial Brain Trust about the Council on Foreign Relations, and his brand new, wonderful book, I highly recommend it, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. So filling in all of those years since 1976. Lawrence Shoup, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
Great to have you here. You say the Council on Foreign Relations is the world's most powerful private organization. I bet you couldn't get most people to come up with that answer in a public poll. Is that true? How do you explain that? And what is the Council on Foreign Relations for those who don't hear about it every day?
Well, it's a behind-the-scenes organization. That's why people don't hear about it. It's part of the deep state that operates behind the scenes, not in total secrecy, although there is some secrecy involved. They have annual reports, and they have a magazine called Foreign Affairs Magazine, and they have a very big website. So information is available on this organization, but it does operate behind the scenes, kind of quietly. It just to give you a little bit of a flavor of it, I looked at the administration since the Carter administration, since 1976, at the early 1977, covered all those administrations in the top foreign policy, in many cases domestic policy, to Treasury Secretary and so on, looked at all the policymakers and found that 80% of them were members of this organization. Now, that gets into the uniqueness of the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a private organization made up of people that are mostly... there's really two groups that are key to it, and that's the intellectual side of it and then the business side of it. So it's a private organization of almost 5,000 members, and so it's a very big membership organization, but it's also a think tank. Most organizations are either one or the other. You know, you have the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and Hoover Institute and so on, American Enterprise Institute. Those are think tanks. Then you have private organizations like the NAACP, which is a membership organization. The uniqueness of the council, it brings those two together. And it's if you look over the membership list, and you can find it on the Council on Foreign Relations website, CFR.org, you can look at their annual report and look at their membership. It's really very striking how the number of people that are powerful in one section of U.S. society or another, and the numbers that are billionaires, extremely rich. It's a plutocratic organization. The capitalist class, what I call the capitalist class, and I define that in the book, are the people that really run the organization. They're the ones that run the board of directors. The chairman of the council, for example, in the last in this period that I'm talking about, from 1976 to the present, there's been David Rockefeller for many years, then Peter Peterson. Both of those are billionaires. And then Robert Rubin and Carla Hills have been more recently the co-chairs of the Council on Foreign Relations. So the leadership, the top leadership, that's why I call it Wall Street's think tank, because the top leadership is connected to especially finance capital, but also in general people that are extremely rich, billionaires. And my website, I have a lawrenceshoup.com. I have a list of over 100 Council on Foreign Relations members that are extremely wealthy. So it's a plutocratic organization. The Rockefellers have been very prominent, but also other American families that are important, like financially important, like the Vanderbilts, the DuPonts, the Mellons. They've all been active in the Council on Foreign Relations over the years. So here we have an organization works behind the scenes, but is extremely powerful when it actually comes to making policy, both putting people in office and also with their think tank planning future policies for the United States and for increasingly for the world. One of my chapters goes into all the council's connections in the worldwide policy planning fields. whether it's the Bilderberger Group or the Trilateral Commission, the Group of 30, or the people that meet at Davos, Council on Foreign Relations people are very prominent in those various forums around the world. The Council is a private U.S. organization, so its membership of almost 5,000 are U.S. citizens. But you have people coming from other countries. Rupert Murdoch, for example, came from Australia, became a U.S. citizen, and, of course, then got into the Council on Foreign Relations. And you get into the Council on Foreign Relations by applying. Oftentimes, they recruit certain people, but you have to apply, and the Board of Directors has to approve. Another aspect of the Council is their corporate membership. They have corporations as members, and, of course, it's the ones you would expect, the biggest, most multinational corporations. There's J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, and Citibank and Bank of America, or ExxonMobil and Chevron and other big oil companies, Hess and others, are corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations. That's another unique aspect of the Council.
So toward the beginning, Lawrence, you said that 80% of policymakers are members of the Council on Foreign Relations, if I heard that right. Could you just explain who counts as a policymaker?
Yeah. This was the top policymakers since the Carter administration. I looked at the president, the vice president, the secretary of treasury, the secretary of state, secretary of defense, the national security advisor. Those are the main ones that I looked at, and it amounts to almost 100 people, and almost 80 of them were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. So this is an extraordinarily high number of people from one organization. That were top policymakers. I didn't look at all the policymakers. In the Obama administration, for example, there's a number of others, the Energy Secretary, the Department of Health, Education, Welfare Secretary, the Commerce Secretary. They're all members of the Council on Foreign Relations as well. So I didn't look at every cabinet member or every policymaker, just the top ones. And to give a sample there from the period from Carter to Obama, including Obama, taking it up the story up to the end of 2014. I also looked at a lot of people that were advisors on various committees. The State Department has an advisory committee. The Defense Department has an advisory committee. The CIA has an advisory committee. Looking at those advisory committees, I found that over 70% of those members of those advisory committees were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. So behind the scenes, this organization is constantly working to... What do they do, of course, is bring together different elements of the capitalist class and the professional class, that is, intellectuals at universities and at other think tanks. They bring them together to plan policy and then develop consensus about what the policy should be, and then, through their members in the government, insert those policies into the government. And this has a long history. The Council on Foreign Relations was founded in 1921, the joining of two groups, an earlier group called the Council on Foreign Relations, and the group that came out of the inquiry, which was the post-war planning bodies, which Woodrow Wilson set up during the First World War to plan for the post-war world. Those were more intellectual. So it's combined a business organization called the Council on Foreign Relations, which was actually founded in 1918, to do planning and connection with other capitalists around the world in order to improve U.S. business activities, including trade. And those two organizations joined in 1921. And ever since then, the Council on Foreign Relations has been, I think, increasingly powerful. I think a very important change took place towards more power in the Second World War period, when the Council was very active in planning the post-war world for the Second World War. To show the ambition of the Council, on September 12, 1939, only 12 days after Hitler invaded Poland and plunging the world into the Second World War, only 12 days after that, and several years before the United States joined the war, the Council on Foreign Relations leaders met with State Department officials saying, we need to start planning for the post-war world. Imagine, the world just started the war only 12 days before, and the Council's already thinking about, well, let's plan for the post-war world. So they set up a series of planning groups of over 100 people that were doing planning for the post-war world. And once the United States got into the war, those groups were integrated into the State Department planning for the post-war world. And that's the how the post-war world got going in terms of having a UN and International Monetary Fund and World Bank. These were things that the Council on Foreign Relations was planning as ways to integrate the post-war world and make it a world that was more open to U.S. power, U.S. influence, and U.S. capital, U.S. businesses.
And those pre-U.S. entry into the war plans for the post-war world, were those predicated on the idea that the U.S. would be entering the war?
Yes, it was predicated. In fact, they came out in 1941 with what was called the Grand Area Plan. The Council on Foreign Relations came up with this plan. And that was the minimum living space of the United States. And these memos, they made up memos. They sent out memos. They had over almost 700 memos over the period of 1939 to 1945. And they sent all these to all the main bureaus of the U.S. government, including and also the president and vice president, got these memos. And one of them was the Grand Area of 1941. And it outlined the living space of the United States. It said that if Japan started to go into Southeast Asia, that would be violate the minimum living space that the United States needed to have a prosperous economy. Southeast Asia was seen even at that early date. Of course, this was later on stressed in the lead-up to the U.S. involvement in the what's usually called the Vietnam War, the U.S. war on Southeast Asia, on Vietnam. And they said that that was the minimum living space. If Japan started to intervene there, the United States would have to go to war. And Japan recognized that and decided to have a preemptive attack at Pearl Harbor. So these plans, they had the unconditional surrender came out of these plans. This was a plan that the Council put forward in 1942. Let's have an unconditional surrender for the Axis powers. And so these plans were very important, and this shows the Council's long history making grand strategic plans and developing consensus among those that matter, that is, the Wall Street people, the big capitalists, and the intellectuals. And, of course, the intellectuals are the ones that you would expect, the Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Johns Hopkins, University of Chicago, Stanford. Those are the big universities that have very heavy numbers of the Council on Foreign Relations, people on their faculty, members on their faculty. They're a nationwide organization. They have branches all over the country, but these universities are big centers of Council on Foreign Relations members.
Just one more quick question about World War II, because I'm interested. When President Roosevelt got himself reelected, saying he would stay out of the war, and then, of course, got into the war after Pearl Harbor, what was his relationship with the Council on Foreign Relations, which was, as I understand it, wanting the U.S. to get into the war and to dominate a chunk of the globe after the war?
Roosevelt was not a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Much of his administration was, for example, Henry Stimson, the Secretary of Defense, they called the Secretary of War in those days. He was a member, a longtime member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And one of his main advisors, Norman Davis, was the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. So they had, and a lot of sub-level people in the State Department and the Defense Department. Cordell Hull was also not a member, but Cordell Hull's big advisor also was Norman Davis, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. So the Council work. This is often the case. The Council is not, the president is not a member of the Council, but of course there have been seven presidents that have been members of the Council on Foreign Relations, but Roosevelt was not one of them.
We're speaking with Lawrence Shoup, whose new book is Wall Street's Think Tank, about the Council on Foreign Relations. When people join, I mean, are all of these top officials and their advisors, people who get those positions in government and then suddenly are recruited and join the Council on Foreign Relations? Or are they people who've been members for decades and their parents and grandparents were members and they end up in these high offices?
It's a mix of those two things. It's mostly the latter, the people that have been members of the Council on Foreign Relations for a long time and make their connections there. Are the ones that go into office. But there are some cases where they weren't members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and while they're in office or when they leave office, they then become members of the Council on Foreign Relations. A couple good examples of the former, that is, people that were longtime members of the Council or got their start in the Council, are Henry Kissinger and Condoleezza Rice. Those individuals got their start in the Council on Foreign Relations as far as meeting people that really puts their careers ahead. In the case of Kissinger, he was an obscure Harvard professor when the Council wanted to do a study on nuclear weapons and foreign policy, and they hired Kissinger as a staff person to, this was 1955, you know, well before Kissinger was prominent, and he wrote a book under the auspices of the Council, and it was the way the study groups work is they bring in people like Kissinger, intelligent young academics, and then they have a whole group of people that are interested in this topic, and they maybe up to 40 people or even 45 people will be in the study group, and they will, for a period of months, even years sometimes, will meet and discuss various issues, and they'll have someone that's a rapporteur, they call them, and they take notes, and then they oftentimes write up a book or an article or some other publication based on the thinking of the study group and their own ideas as well, but basically the thinking of the study group. Well, Kissinger wrote a book that became famous called Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, which was a Council on Foreign Relations book. There at the Council, then he became a member of the Council, and there is where he met the Rockefellers, who were prominent in the Council. David Rockefeller became a member of the Council in 1941. And was the director of the Council from 1949 on, and now is the honorary chairman. David Rockefeller is 100 years old this year, and he's still prominent in the Council thinking. So anyway, Kissinger met the Rockefellers there, became an advisor to Nelson Rockefeller, also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and then that's how he became prominent enough to get in the circles that later on led to Nixon tapping him as Secretary of State, first National Security Advisor, then later Secretary of State. In the case of Condoleezza Rice, again, obscure intellectual at Stanford, and she was, they wanted to recruit at this time. The Council was changing, gradually changing from being an all-male organization before 1970 to becoming an organization that had some women in the organization, gradually increasing. And in the 80s, they saw Condoleezza Rice as someone who was interested in the Soviet Union, which was something that the Council was working from the very beginning to try to destroy the Soviet Union. So they saw Rice as an expert that would be, and an African-American woman, so that added the diversity of the Council that they were trying to gradually implement. It was a very slow process, but they gradually were bringing in people of color and women into the Council. So Rice became a Council member, and then became active on some of the Council various groups, study groups, and chaired some of the Council meetings and began to meet various people that then became important in her career, the Bush family and Schultz, George Schultz, who was also at Stanford and was a director of some of the important companies like Chevron. And she got onto the Chevron board, and then her career was launched there. Therefore, these are a couple examples of people that, through their connections to the Council, became prominent, and then also, of course, financially, could become wealthy because they meet people that are big capitalists, and they can get on boards, or they can become advisors. In the case of Kissinger, founded Kissinger Associates, which advises multinational corporations on their politics. So Kissinger now didn't start out wealthy, but now he's extremely wealthy. Condoleezza Rice didn't start out wealthy either, but now, because of her corporate boards, she can become a capitalist herself. So these are the personal advantages that you can gain by being a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, if you have the wherewithal and the expertise that the Council is looking for. And, of course, you're willing to serve the capitalist class in their interests.
And what about Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton, whose prominence, of course, led to the current prominence of Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, Madeleine Albright, of course, is an immigrant, was born and raised, I think, in Czechoslovakia, I understand. And she came into the United States as a very ambitious person, but she must come from some kind of upper-class background because she was right away starting to interact with higher circles in the United States and married a very wealthy newspaper, married into the Patterson family, and became her expertise. She also worked very hard to get a Ph.D., and her expertise in foreign policy led her to be with the plutocratic kind of connection with her her spouse, got her into the Council on Foreign Relations. And then because she was active in Democratic Party circles, she became a friend of Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton, of course, being very ambitious and knowing that the council was pretty important, asked Albright to get him into the Council on Foreign Relations. And this was in the 1980s. So he got into the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, this was part of the networks that allowed him to gain the political support, including financial support, the media support that you need, and the advisors that you need to try to become president. I think those are the three key things, financial, media, and advisors, that any presidential candidate needs to have. And Clinton, of course, got a lot of that from the Council on Foreign Relations. And once he got in office, almost his whole administration, the top people in foreign policy and many of them in domestic policy, were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, Albright has went on to become the Secretary of State and also the U.N. Head of the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And that reminds me of an interesting story about her, that she during the 1990s, there was also the current, which later became more dominant, let's get rid of Saddam Hussein, let's take over Iraq. And at a meeting in the Clinton White House, Madeleine Albright asked the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Hugh Sheldon, whether or not he could arrange for a plane to fly low and slow over Iraq so it would be shot down and you'd have a reason to go to war with Saddam Hussein. And Hugh Sheldon, in his memoirs, said he was very, this is the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said he was very angry at that question. And he said to Albright, yes, Madam Secretary, we can arrange to have, as soon as we get your ass trained, he used the word ass in his memoirs, so as soon as you get your ass trained to fly the plane, you'll be able to drive it, just fly it just as low and slow as you want and get shot down and cause a war.
So, George W. Bush made that exact same proposal to Tony Blair in the White House on January 31st, 2003, and the two of them walked out to a press conference and said they were trying to avoid war if at all possible. So these ideas are clearly bipartisan, right? Madeleine Albright has the same inclinations as George W. Bush. Maybe he got it from her. I don't know. But what is the council's relation to partisan politics? Because, you know, groups and individuals on the left always say, pick one of the two parties, the one that looks slightly better, and put everything into that party. The Council on Foreign Relations, pushing clearly very unpopular plutocratic ideas, doesn't pick the party that seems more plutocratic and push it further to the right. It invests heavily in both parties. Why is that, and has that always been the case?
That's pretty much always been the case. They've always had the first president, for example, of the Council on Foreign Relations, this before they had chairman. At the beginning, they had just had president, was John W. Davis, who was a Democrat and ran for president in 1924. He was still president. He stayed president of the Council on Foreign Relations when he ran for president. So they've been ahead, and of course they have a very large number of Republicans as well. Eisenhower, of course, was active in the council before he became president. So they have both parties. Rockefeller, of course, Steve Rockefeller and the other Rockefellers, prominent Republicans. So they have people from both parties, and the moderates, the middle of the road, the establishment from both parties are the ones dominant in the council. Or, you know, in the council or active or very closely connected to the council. Now, in the case of our current presidential campaign, the people most closely connected to the council are Hillary Clinton, whose husband's a member and whose daughter's a member, but she's never become a member. She's gone to speak before the council. When she became, when the council was setting up its new office in Washington, D.C., she helped open the council. She went there for the opening and said, it's very nice that the council now has a headquarters so close to the White House, because now we just have to go around the corner to find out what we should be thinking. And that's the quote from Hillary Clinton.
to get our orders.
Close so we can know what we should be thinking. So she's close to the council. And then on the Republican side, it's Jeb Bush, of course, that's close to the council. He has a large number of advisors that are Council on Foreign Relations people, including this guy Wolfowitz, Paul Wolfowitz, who was so instrumental in getting the United States into the Iraq War. But there were lots of other guys. I have a chapter in the book, of course, on the Iraq War. The council was behind this Iraq War, council people. And they had lots of publications that pushed getting into the war.
And so based on past experience, the council favoring another Clinton or another Bush, what's their track record? I mean, how often does the Council on Foreign Relations get what it wants? Did it want the Iran deal destroyed? Does it want Syria overthrown? I mean, can we predict what's going to happen based on the council's point of view?
To some extent, you don't want to overstate it and make it sound like this is an all-powerful organization and there's no free will by any other forces in the world. That's not true, but it is true that you can get an advance notice about what the plutocrats of the United States are thinking and what they're proposing and what they want to implement by looking at the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a big job. I spent years writing this book, and I spent many more years collecting data on it because here's an organization that has thousands of meetings every year, that publishes a number of books, and since about 1990, I think they've had tens of thousands of publications of different kinds. You know, there's blogs, there's articles, there's Foreign Affairs magazine articles, as well as articles other places. They testify before Congress. They have their members all over the place in the media, most of the time not identified as Council on Foreign Relations people. Last night I was watching the News Hour with Judy Woodruff, who is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and she had Vin Weber there, who was identified as a former congressman from Minnesota. Well, he's a director of the Council on Foreign Relations and advisor to Jeb Bush. They didn't identify him as an advisor to Jeb Bush. They didn't identify him as a director of the council, not just a member, but a director of the Council on Foreign Relations. They have 35 directors. They didn't identify him that way, and he gave his views without anyone knowing that he's representing the views of the Council on Foreign Relations in many respects. So you don't know oftentimes, unless you study the organization and look at its makeup, whether some individual appears to be advocating something and maybe have some other connection, like maybe he's a journalist for some magazine or newspaper, and that's how they identify him. But he's representing these other views. So it's a big job to try to cover, the Council on Foreign Relations.
But you have done it. You have done this job for us. I wish we could go on, but the clock's running out. If people want to learn more, they can pick up this book, and I highly recommend it. Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014, by Lawrence Shoup. Lawrence Shoup, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, political journalists would likely tell you they take the Black Lives Matter movement seriously. But it's up to us to tell them that that has to mean more than prompting presidential candidates to say the words aloud. We'll talk about some potential elements of an actual criminal justice reform agenda with Michelle Jawando, Vice President of Legal Progress at the Center for American Progress. Also on the show, many people have concerns about what happens to their food. Whatever it is they do to a tomato that lets it get shipped halfway around the world and sit on a shelf for 2 weeks, that tends to be a story about science or marketing, but not usually about the rights of the people that grow the food. That's where the idea of food sovereignty comes in. We'll discuss what that means with Beverly Bell of the group Other Worlds. All that's coming up, but first, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. When an FBI agent pretends to be from Group X and deceives someone into thinking they're participating in a weapons purchase or a terror plot with Group X, that is not evidence that Group X seeks weapons or is plotting terror. So when the Associated Press runs a story, as they did October 5th, reporting a thrilling account of how the FBI, with Moldovan authorities, disrupted a smuggling ring that was trying to sell nuclear material to ISIS, and it turns out that no one involved in the sting were members of or had any connection to ISIS, then, as Adam Johnson, writing for Fair, points out, it is neither appropriate nor accurate to run stories about, as CBS had it, new fears tonight that ISIS is ready to go nuclear. Or how, in Fox News' words, ISIS is trying to buy nukes. Even the Chicago Tribune's rendering that nuclear smugglers shopped radioactive material to Islamic State, other terrorists, is misleading. Since, while it may be true that someone tried to shop something, it's not true that they were ever shopping it to the Islamic State. AP's original report may have included caveats, but they can't feign surprise when those are dropped in subsequent accounts, like that of the International Business Times, which warned readers of ISIS working with Russian gangs to build a radioactive dirty bomb, before just barely being stopped by the FBI. One narrative makes a juicy movie plot. The other reflects reality. Journalists shouldn't have to be encouraged to pick a side. It's been noted that while numerous online polls from Time magazine to the Drudge Report found that most people thought Senator Bernie Sanders carried the day at the Democratic presidential candidates' debate, mainstream pundits overwhelmingly deemed Hillary Clinton the winner. Using this sort of surface-level criteria, the New York Times cited crisp answers, while the Washington Post described a self-assured performance that disconnect people from electoral politics left and right. But rather than declare a victor at all, journalists might have used airtime to explore some telling moments, like the one in which CNN's Anderson Cooper badgered Sanders for opposing the CIA's illegal war on Nicaragua. Robert Naiman of Just Foreign Policy flagged the point where Cooper said, quote, "The question is really about electability here, and that's what I'm trying to get at. You, the Republican attack ad against you in a general election, it writes itself. You supported the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. You honeymooned in the Soviet Union, and just this weekend you said you're not a capitalist. Doesn't that ad write itself?" Close quote. As Naiman notes, millions of Americans supported the Sandinistas in Nicaragua after that group overthrew the U.S.-installed Somoza dictatorship and promised to address Nicaragua's extreme poverty and lack of basic services like education and health care for the majority of the population. Americans from many walks of life opposed the Reagan administration's organization of a terrorist army called the Contras to attack the Nicaraguan government. That solidarity movement eventually passed the Boland Amendment that cut off U.S. funding to the CIA's army, which led the White House to fund them illegally through arms sales to Iran. During the ensuing scandal known as Iran-Contra, Anderson Cooper was working, as it happens, for the CIA, a paid job he held for 2 summers. Even without that biographical detail, though, it speaks volumes that Cooper is comfortable understanding his agency employment as an irrelevant non-issue while presenting having opposed the illegal CIA war on Nicaragua as an obvious electoral liability. And then finally, one of the biggest audience responses during the debate came when Sanders agreed with Hillary Clinton that focus on her email server was a distraction. But as Lee Fong at The Intercept pointed out, TV coverage only stressed part of that story, the part about the political impact of Sanders expressing solidarity with Clinton. MSNBC's report, for example, cut from Sanders' comment, quote, "The secretary is right, and that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails," close quote, to his words, quote, "Enough of the emails, let's talk about the real issues facing America," close quote. Well, what came in between that MSNBC and others cut out was Sanders saying to CNN's Cooper, quote, "Anderson, let me say something about the media as well. I go around the country, talk to a whole lot of people. Middle class in this country is collapsing. We have 27 million people living in poverty. We have massive wealth and income inequality. Our trade policies have cost us millions of decent jobs. The American people want to know whether we're going to have a democracy or an oligarchy as a result of Citizens United. Enough of the emails. Let's talk about the real issues facing America," close quote. Sanders, in other words, wasn't just criticizing Republicans. He was also criticizing media that prioritize sensationalism over basic economic realities. Should we be surprised that media wanted to skip over that bit? Well, we can't improve on the words of investigative journalist and media critic George Seldes. The most sacred cow of the press is the press itself. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Purportedly independent investigators deem reasonable the actions of Cleveland police, who fatally shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice within seconds of arrival on the scene. The Fairfax, Virginia Sheriff's Office released video of officers in hazmat suits tasering shackled, hooded Natasha McKenna to death to demonstrate the deputy's professionalism and restraint. Many in media, too, seem more invested in teasing out how such outrages actually, when you look into it, pass legal muster than in asking what needs to be changed so that they don't. If Black Lives Matter is to be more than a shibboleth, politicians need only say out loud in debates, it will mean pushing criminal justice reform higher up on media's agenda. Here to discuss how that can happen is Michelle Jawando. She's Vice President for Legal Progress at the Center for American Progress. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Michelle Jawando.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, some will always call each example of police misconduct that goes unsanctioned an aberration, even as they pile up. But it seems like a critical mass of people have come to see that some of the structural elements of the criminal justice system are themselves a problem, and particularly for people of color. That makes an opportunity to press for real improvements, some big and bold, and some maybe more achievable and closer to hand. Some may be as simple as collecting data on police-involved killings.
That's exactly right. There's a conversation happening about kind of the inequities and the way that the basic functioning of the criminal justice system, whether we're talking about police practices, use of force, aggressive policing, arrest and prosecution policies, whether we're thinking about things like the severity of criminal sentences and the disparate impact many of these policies have on communities of color. And so now that we are at the center of the debate, it is time to really look at, well, what are those policies that we can put in place to address some of these challenges.
Well, yeah, because I think there's a lot of anger and outrage and folks who say, you know, the whole system is corrupt. And at the same time, we want to translate that into some things that can be done today, you know, and then some things that can be done next week, and then some things that maybe will take 5 or 10 years. But there are things that could be changed right now.
One of the things we talk about is implicit bias training and the need for almost ongoing training for all federal law enforcement officers and state and local police involved in federal task forces. And we made that nexus because how else do you kind of connect federal law enforcement training with state and locals? One of the reasons we think that this training must be ongoing, similar to how attorneys have to do continuing legal education, if we start to acknowledge that there is a difference in the way that we see each other and view each other, and sometimes our subconscious acts on that without that knowledge. So, for instance, in the case of Tamir Rice, he's a 12-year-old boy, but we know social scientists tell us that African-American boys in particular are seen as usually 5 years older. So when that police arrived at the scene and shot Tamir Rice, we know he called into the office, 20-year-old man down. Now, what was it about that interaction that immediately saw this 12-year-old boy, not as a boy, but as a 20-year-old man? And so that's what implicit bias training looks at, and that's one of the many solutions we put forth.
Well, it's interesting because the bias training tries to interrupt that guilt loop, you know, that to take away the idea that only racists would racially profile. So I think that's actually a key component because it takes the conversation out of a kind of pro-con and says, look, but there are best practices here and let's enact them, you know. Another one of those, which I alluded to earlier, is just getting the information about police-involved killings. One of the things that the media did show up as we began talking about this after Ferguson was you couldn't even get the information because the information is not there.
Exactly. I mean, you even had the director of the FBI say that it is unfortunate that we have better data from the Washington Post and the Guardian on police-involved shootings than we do at the federal government level. And so that's something that we can change overnight. And I know the President's Task Force looking at 21st century policing, this was one of the recommendations we put forth that it seems like they would like to make some movement on. And it's important that we recognize this because that then gives us a baseline so that we can understand where the problems are and that we can develop then smart laws and policies to address what many people feel anecdotally is this kind of inappropriate and illegal use of force.
Well, I think it's interesting that California law enforcement, who will now have to record race ethnicity data on stops and what happens after that, are sort of complaining that some of them anyway, well, this will cause us to racially profile. We didn't do it in the past, but now if we have to actually record the race and ethnicity of people that we arrest, that will lead us to think about it in a way that we weren't thinking about it before. There's always a kind of a pushback on the collection of information, but it seems to me that from reporters' perspective and from policy advocates' perspective, more information ought to be non-controversial in a way. I mean, we ought to be able to all be behind more sunlight.
This is a very difficult thing to grapple with, right? Because we have to continually think about the way that race and class and socioeconomic status are wrapped up into our notions of policing and law enforcement and safety and community. But yet, if we do not confront what are very real disparities in how people of color are treated in the system, and if we don't pay attention to what are the real facts underlying that behavior, then there's no way we can move forward to rebuild trust. And the reality is, and this is one of the things that I encourage my friends in law enforcement, is that the reality is you cannot be an effective person in law enforcement without the support and the respect and the trust of the local communities in which you serve. That relationship is sacrosanct and it is so important. And yet you have to challenge yourself to figure out how you repair what we know now are fissures all over the country and that relationship. And this is one of the ways to do that.
Let me ask you finally and briefly, what role would you like to see criminal justice questions playing in electoral politics right now? I mean, is it enough a part of the conversation, do you think?
You know, I often say if we are a country that holds ourselves out as the shining city on the hill, then we have to look at the damage that we have done to communities, particularly African American and Latino, poor communities in this country because of disparate treatment and policing, or whether it's this history of mass incarceration in these communities. And we have to ask ourselves, are we really ready to make the moral changes that are necessary in order to repair these communities?
We've been speaking with Michelle Jawando of the Center for American Progress. Find them online at americanprogress.org. Michelle Jawando, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
From keeping pink slime out of school lunches to demanding labeling to show which of their foods are genetically modified, Americans are learning to raise their voice when it comes to what they eat. That activism generally focuses on the consumer end of things, where most of us mainly are. But there's a growing awareness that food is not simply a product, it's a system. And it starts, for many foods, at the farm. If we want to talk about the right to have a say in what we eat, the conversation has to involve the rights of the people who grow it and our relationship to one another. That's one of the ideas behind the U.S. Food Sovereignty Prize, awarded by an alliance of food justice and food producer groups. One recipient this year is the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, a group that works with family farmers, particularly African American farmers, to develop self-supporting communities. Joining us to talk about the work and what it means is Beverly Bell. She's the coordinator of Other Worlds, the women-led education and movement-building collaborative. She joins us by phone from Oakland. Welcome back to Counterspin, Beverly Bell.
Thank you.
What I wanted to ask you first is how you introduce people to the idea of food sovereignty. How do you explain what that means?
Well, there are two concepts that your listeners will probably be aware of, and I'll just state them briefly. The first concept is food security, which means that everyone has the right to adequate quantity of food, to quality of food, and to have food on time. That is, when people are hungry and need it. It's a great concept in moments of dire emergency, but it is all too often used to justify what is in fact dumping of taxpayer-supported U.S. agribusiness-grown foods, and I'm thinking particularly of rice growers, but also wheat and corn growers, who are then able to dump their foods into low-income countries, creating situations of endless dependence and putting farmers and local production completely out of business. So again, good concept, but how it's used is not helpful and it's often very, very harmful. Then there is the concept of food justice that is increasingly growing, especially through youth and people of color-led movements in the U.S., which looks at structural racism in the food system and looks at the need for local community-controlled production for local consumption. Food sovereignty takes both of those concepts at their core and builds upon it to say that we need to look at food as a global system, and we need to look at the structures behind it, which you referenced in your introduction, Janine. Food sovereignty is about the right of all people and all nations to have access to their own food grown domestically to support local production, food that is agroecologically grown, that supports the environment, not undermines it, as industrial agriculture does, food that looks at questions of inequity and ensures that small farmers and normally excluded communities actually have what they need to grow, which often means the right to land, the right to water, et cetera. And it looks even further at so-called free trade pacts, looking at how the policies of the U.S. and other industrialized nations and the World Trade Organization have undermined and destroyed local production all over the world. I know that sounds like a lot. It could be stated very, very simply. It's the right to grow. It is the right to live on land by rural peoples. It is the right of everyone to be able to eat domestically grown food in a way that supports each nation's economy and the sustenance of its culture. And it's really at its core about citizens reclaiming food and agricultural system from the corporations.
Well, I remember learning about sub-Saharan African countries that grew cotton for export but couldn't afford the shirts that were made from it. And I think the idea that farmers should ever be food insecure is almost iconic proof that something fundamental is wrong or is broken, that food producers should ever be hungry. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, one of the recipients of this year's U.S. Food Sovereignty Prize. Their reason for being and their work for some 40 years now really draws together the idea of civil and human rights with the rights of food producers. What is it that they do?
The Federation of Southern Cooperatives is one of my favorite groups in the U.S. They were started in 1967 by the five main civil rights groups who understood that it's not enough just to have political and social rights. One needs economic justice at the same time. And so they started this economic arm for African Americans in the Deep South. Incidentally, I just want to underscore here the incredible work of economist Jessica Gordon Nemhard, who has found that in every moment of African American organizing in the U.S., there has been a very, very strong accompanying growth of co-ops. And it's something that's so important that we don't often think about when we think of civil rights. But here along came this fantastic organization to support African American farmers who are victims of both racism at every levels, especially in the USDA, which is often called the last plantation, and are also victims of the same thing that all farmers are, which is land being taken from their hands and put into mega industrial food production. This coalition today represents more than 30 cooperatives of farmers across the Deep South, and about 95% of them are African American, the remainder being Latino, Native, and White. And this is a way to pool power and to help each other grow and market, and also to add legislative and judicial power behind the need to really change systems so that African American farmers do not continue being put out of business, which is what has been happening. I would just add one more thing, which is that today less than 1% of agricultural land is in the hands of black farmers, and the number is going down all the time. So the Federation of Southern Cooperatives is working hard to reverse that trend.
Well, the Federation is sharing the Food Sovereignty Prize with a group that advocates the rights of the Garifuna people of Honduras, whose traditional lands are being taken by oil palm plantations and by tourism developments. It might sound like it's very far away, but it's really all the same struggle, isn't it?
It's all the same struggle. In the case of Honduras, actually, the U.S. was involved in a coup d'etat against the democratically elected president, Mel Zelaya, a few years back. And one of the main reasons for that coup d'etat was because there was a strong land reform movement of indigenous peoples and black peoples who have been pushed off of their land. So the group that you mentioned, Janine, is called the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras, or OFRANE by its Spanish acronym. And these are 46 communities of Afro-Indigenous people called the Garifuna, who like the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, are working very, very hard to keep land in their hands so that they can live and farm, grow, and in their case, fish their own foods and be left alone with what is theirs so as to live a fully entitled life of the rights and justice and democracy and community that they deserve.
The day after the awarding of the Food Sovereignty Prize, another prize is awarded that sounds similar, the World Food Prize. They sound similar, but they're different in significant ways. What can you tell us finally about the difference between the Food Sovereignty Prize and what's known as the World Food Prize?
Yes, the Food Sovereignty Prize was conceived as a counterpoint to the World Food Prize. The World Food Prize is a corporate-backed operation that basically promotes the idea of tech fixes to hunger. It has given awards to even Monsanto, whom we know to be the great monster in opposition to food sovereignty. The Federation of Southern Cooperatives and OFRANE, the Afro-Indigenous rural farmers in Honduras, know, as do so many other groups around the world, what is the real answer to hunger. It is not technological fixes. It is not individual initiatives. It is creating a system of global economics that is more just, whereby everyone has the resources to access the food that they need.
We've been speaking with Beverly Bell of Other Worlds. They're online at otherworldsarepossible.org. You can learn more about the Federation of Southern Cooperatives at federationsouthernco-op.com and more about the U.S. Food Sovereignty Prize at usfoodsovereigntyalliance.org. Thank you very much, Beverly Bell, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Janine, thank you so much. Great to speak with you.
And that's it for Counterspin this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can check out FAIR's website. It's fair.org, and that's the place to sign up for our email list. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. This week on Radio EcoShock, it's permaculture, the big picture, and solutions for climate change. There's no time for a big introduction. It's a packed show. We're just going to dive right in with the 15th Annual International Permaculture Convergence in London, September 9th, 2015. You'll get a cool talk by Albert Bates from the farm in Tennessee. Then Albert interviews Transition Town's founder Rob Hopkins for Radio EcoShock. We wrap up with the longtime Australian permaculturalist Rosemary Murrow, who tells us Western permies are the minority compared to the big movements in East Asia, India, Africa, and the Pacific Islands. If you don't know what permaculture is when we start, you will by the end of this intensive radio feature. Here is Albert Bates in London.
Welcome to the climate change session. As you probably agree, it's very important to highlight and showcase permaculture and what it's doing in climate change mitigation. We had quite a lot of offers for this session. We chose three very good presentations. First of all, we've got Albert Bates, former president of the Global Eco-Village Network and currently head of their NGO delegation at the UN Climate Talks in Paris this December, holding their plenary event called Eco-Villages 10,001 Solutions for Climate Change. Albert has worked for 40 years in the field of integrated development and has trained people from more than 60 countries. He is also the author of numerous books on energy, environment and history, The Biochar Solution, Financial Collapse Survival Guide, and most recently, Pour Evian on Your Radishes. Please welcome Thanks.
Okay. You know, this topic is a bit daunting. Are there any hedge fund managers in the room? If you don't want to say, it's okay. You know, if you're a hedge fund manager, right about now, you're pretty worried about what's a safety place for your fund. What should you be putting hedge on? And you're worried about silver and gold. They're manipulated. Bitcoin, the yuan, renminbis, all manipulated. We know from the LIBOR scandal, all that stuff is very ephemeral. Commercial real estate in London, anyone? So there are no longer any safe havens. And these are manipulated by kleptocrats at best, CIA and MI6 at worst. Second homes on private island might look good now, but what about in 5 years? And here's, you know, a safe haven I'm going to give you. This is what this is about. If you read that it was about eco-villages, yes, sort of. That's a subset of the larger picture. Eco-villages that are carbon negative, that continuously build value, that have social worth that exceeds any currency worth. If you're interested either as an investor or designer, by all means, let's talk. I came to this by going through the carbon cycle and looking at sources and sinks and seeing what are our points of intervention. And you need to work on both sides of the ledger. You're going to change the dynamic, reverse climate change, get us back to a pre-Anthropocene concentration in the atmosphere and the oceans. There's really only one sink that you have available to you, and that's the soil. It's the ground. It's what's under our feet. And that's the one that we can most safely work with. The tools that we've come to use are these available tools on the sink side. You're not going to like geoengineering. You can't afford it. It won't work. But these things work, and they can scale quickly. And when I use the term permafuels down here, I mean local, socially responsive, ecologically restorative, waste-to-energy renewable systems with carbon capture and sequestration. Here's an example. This is a beaner. It's a camping stove. This is the beaner.
Can you buy one?
Yeah, it's 20 euros. It comes from Italy. It's worldstove.com. You take this on your backpack. It's called a beaner because you can put a carabiner through this hole, stick it on your belt or your backpack. You take it camping with you. You get to your campsite. You start looking around for some pine needles or pine cones or cardboard or scrap wood or different kinds of things out of the dump. You look for a can that's in the dump. Any can will do. It doesn't matter whether you're in India or the Philippines or South Africa. All cans are the same dimension. And so it's actually geared to fit exactly into this space. Poke a few holes at the bottom. Drop your material inside. Drop a lit match in. Takes a few minutes to get going. You're going to get a little bit of smoke at first, a yellow flame. But as it gets going, it heats up, the metal heats up. And so as it does, it forces the gases out of the biomass. The gases travel up the inside of the jacket because of the holes I punched at the bottom. As they travel up, they find that there's nowhere to exit, so they enter back in at these ports on top, these little venturis. And as they come through, they cross over the flame. And as they cross over the flame, they ignite. So now you have this blue mandala, like looking down at a gas range. And there's no smoke because it's cut off oxidation. It's cut off the oxygen flow below. And it's becoming pyrolysis, absence of oxygen, heating the biomass, turning it into gas, burning the gas. All you're getting is a little water vapor coming off the top. It doesn't create any ash. You can cook on the stove like this with one load for about 90 minutes because it's about 30% more efficient. So you've made your Norse soup mix or your spaghetti, and now you're done and you quench the fire and you take out what's left, which is hard carbon, biochar, and you put it in the soil. You just had a carbon negative camping experience. You've sequestered your footprint. Now, there are models of this. The BioLite I didn't bring, but it's a model that produces electricity. So you can charge your laptop or you can charge your cell phone. If you're using GPS on your phone or you have an Apple Watch and you want to charge that overnight while you're camping, you can do it because you've got a little thermocouple that while you're cooking your dinner, it's making biochar and it's giving you back electricity. This is a model that can scale. There are now for sale over-the-counter versions of this that do 100 kilowatts. And they produce biochar for gardens or for other uses, which I'll go through a little. So this is something I showed in the Cuba slideshow for those of you who were there. The idea in both Jordan and Cuba, I talked about cool food, making cool products and branding them as net carbon sequestering. For me, cool is a stickier meme than carbon negative or carbon minus. You have to think about the neurolinguistic patterning and how our reptilian brains respond to tribal cues, right? We're seekers of tribeness amongst our mates, right? This is our evolutionary track, that we are a herd animals. And so we look for cool things. We're cool hunters, all of us, and cool memes. So what we're looking for here is something like cool food that's made putting the biochar at the base of the cacao tree, taking the cacao pods and turning them into biochar, a full cycling. And so you can then brand it as a cool food, like charcoal. I don't know if Craig Sams is here, but here's an idea for you. Cool feed. So now we've learned that the biochar as an alimentary additive has beneficial effects, particularly for farm animals. You can reduce the need for antibiotics. You can greatly drop the supply of antibiotics. And that actually has added impacts in that we're getting some feedback. This is one reason that Big Pharma is mounting an anti-biochar campaign, just like the fake tobacco studies in the 1950s. Their business model depends on selling you more antibiotics. And this is a business model that's going the opposite direction. Cool buildings, so biochar paints and plasters, geotextiles, living roofs. We're actually finding by putting biochar into a clay render or lime render that it works the same way a charcoal filter on a cigarette works. It cleans the air in the room. It takes out pollen and mold spores. This is huge in many parts of the world. If you have hay fever, you can appreciate this. So it's biology, it's room air conditioning, room cleaning of the air, cleaning sick buildings by putting a simple paint that has a charcoal core to it. And it can be several layers deep and it still works if the wall breathes at all. And you can think also about using the biochar in sequence. Your cob building that you built for the course falls apart after a few years or you're not going to need it anymore and you move it. Take that and put that in the garden, and now what have you got? The biochar is going back into the garden. Or it can go onto a living roof, and now you're sequestering carbon in a couple different ways. We're just beginning to tap what some of the things that biochar can do. There's weird science everywhere. Who knew that it can block Wi-Fi or infrared signals? But they're using it now in gully suits for snipers because it blocks your IR signature. And you also have the potential for, if you're worried about the Faraday box effect of the
building that you live in, why not plaster it with biochar? You won't get very good Wi-Fi reception, but you know, you have a comfortable night's sleep with no electromagnetic fields. This also plays into the people who have grow rooms in their basement. Avoid detection. So cool energy, biochar replacing cathodes and fuel cells to create better storage, and new studies from China about the charge potential of charred banana peels. So you can imagine charging phones and things by having a little pyrolytic converter that can make your own battery. And solar refrigerator in Guatemala that's 10% better, 10 times better at flash cooling with a biochar medium under a glass top, meaning that you can make ice with cardboard and aluminum in anywhere where there's direct sunlight using something like biochar. So I showed this in Cuba, and the idea is of a cascade model, stacked functions, multiple yields, and you need to imagine these in the context of whole systems approaches, such as eco-village. The idea that you create, you're doing terra preta formation in everything you do, whether it's building or gardening or energy systems, transportation, and so forth. And you can sequence the material as it goes through the cycle from the time it's harvested. And I take a lot of bamboo and turn it into biochar and can make 3 or 4 wheelbarrow loads in about a half an hour. And then that goes through a compost operation, and actually it helps the compost. It speeds up the compost. I can add it as a very fine powder to compost teas, and it goes to the garden. I can have it as a water treatment. It can go from the water treatment use to be going into conditioner for silage, where it actually reduces the bad ferments in silage and increases the good ferments in silage. And then it's eaten by the cattle over winter, becomes a digestive supplement for the cows. They don't need the antibiotics. It goes into the litter in the barn, and it actually reduces the ammonia smell. And then you go from there as a manure conditioner. It gets hauled away and put into compost. It becomes a soil conditioner. And from the soil amendment, it becomes carbon sequestration, where it's going to stay in the soil because it's recalcitrant carbon. It's a hard crystalline form. It's going to stay there for 1,000 years. It's not going back to become next year's plants. It's in a form that's going to take it from the atmosphere, deprive the atmosphere for a life cycle of considerable length. And then that's actually going to serve the oceans as well, because the oceans are under stress from the atmosphere. So we're hoping to drop the whole thing by putting it all in the soil. I did a study that was in Permaculture Activist, which is now Permaculture Design magazine, and also another one that appeared in Permaculture last year in the UK, that was looking at eco-villages and how much they already are cool. How much they net sequester. And we found that Earth Haven was net sequestering 30% more than its residents' footprints in greenhouse gas emissions from all sources, visitors, travel, businesses, and so forth. If you looked at Ecodorf Siebenlinden, you got a very substantial net sequestration. Findhorn in Scotland, even with all the visitors, because of the Caledonian reforestation efforts that they do. And the farm, my community, 5 times the footprint is being sequestered each year. And that's primarily from forest. Forest is the big wedge. By putting more trees in and keeping those trees growing, bringing them to maturity, using a lot of forest products, we get cool. So this is about how you get cultural traction. And we live in a world of style. We are herd animals. And you have to ask what attracts people. What are the carrots, not the sticks? We've got plenty of sticks coming out of UN climate conferences and scary headlines in the news. What are the carrots? And permaculture, obviously, can provide a very strong carrot. We can have a much better planet if we follow simple rules. And the world, in the world of style, what attracts people is having something that's neat and got a story behind it, and it's a kind of a fun story to tell your friends. We were doing a permaculture course last week in Iceland, and we were doing a design exercise for a local farmer. And the farmer said there's something he required in our design. He wanted a feature in the design that would be quite interesting. So I said, okay, that's the QI component, right? We want something to be quite interesting. The idea of that came around to us. We're doing a quite interesting company now. It's called ECO2. It's in the pre-launch phase. And it's not dissimilar to what Ethan and the folks at TerraGenesis are doing with regenerative real estate design. It's exactly what International Permaculture Design is planning. I'm a CPO of this company, a chief permaculture officer, which is something every company should have, I feel. And we are open source, easily replicated, but we want to reach out and hire you. We will need lots of more designers to do these projects. We apply community-based plus riparian methodology, holistic management, mob grazing, keyline, biochar, energy capture and storage, alley crops, offset density, reafforestation. It's not a secret formula. It's open source. What we're doing is creating a model, beginning with site surveys, going there, living with the people, visioneering with the stakeholders, acquiring needed expertise as needed, Landsat imaging, legal government liaisons. You know, we want to do plant leaf protein, so we bring in Dave Kennedy. Biochar Bob is on the ground right now. Green Capital. Chris Nesbitt came over from Belize to look at the potentials there for different food foresting, bioenergy and protein cascades. The deliverables for the local community: energy independence at 1/7 of the capital expenditures of photovoltaics or wind. A green school. I don't know how many are familiar with John Hardy and what he's doing in Bali. Roadless wilderness preservation, 95% offset. Investor return of investment in the early going of 20 to 30% APR. Net sequestration of approximately 1,000 megatons of carbon per year. Naturally increasing without further intervention, and eco-villages. Our company is just starting off the first grid eco-village community, working at the scale of a watershed with an underserved, disenfranchised, overexploited base population yearning for empowerment and a better future for their children. We're working at the scale of watershed. Our intended first-year deliverables are generating potable water, 100% waste treatment, biomass to energy, food, biofertilizers, bioproteins, and some other products from 200% carbon-negative integrated microbiorefinery for small-scale production. We can't get any of this accomplished without support from the existing residents, so we ask. We become the community. We work together to design our shared future. Scaling up, we can take this to 10 petagrams, 10 gigatons of carbon per year very quickly, 10 years. Fossil fuels are now 5.6 gigatons per year, so it would erase that by nearly double. If you remove fossil fuels expeditiously, we can talk about getting back to pre-industrial atmospheric greenhouse gas levels by mid to late century, barring a clathrate gun already triggered or some other black swan event already in play. In which event, this is still very much the best way to spend the closing of an epoch. Our job is a garden planet that can support continued evolution of life in all its forms. There are many possible routes that these steps can take. They're not mutually exclusive. This is our showcase project, location undisclosed for the moment while the land is being secured. We're working with the government to set aside a huge amount as national park. It's car-free, off-grid, but connected. No export capitalism is required. Accessible to sail routes in the Caribbean, a pirate-proof food forest, a moderate microclimate, a hedge for the future, and a model for all manner of de-development in the degrowth era. We are recruiting here. Before Petra collapse or Ponzi collapse, we can install CPOs in both large and small firms working in any of these fields: biomass, food, fertilizer, energy, waste management. Everything is food for something, and the first step is recapturing waste to assign it value. The opposite is also possible, which is to re-inhabit remnant sanctuaries and secure them from exactly those kinds of firms, setting aside nature preserves protected by indigenous eco-villages. In the first case, you redesign businesses to become more resilient by not being rapists. And the second, you simply disappear your culture into the fabric of the forest and become virtually invisible, quietly restoring the pre-Anthropocene climate as nothing out of the normal for you. there will be people who incline towards either of these.
That was permaculture teacher, author, and activist Albert Bates speaking at the 15th Annual International Permaculture Convergence in London, September 9th, 2015. Albert hails from the farm in Tennessee. Find links to his blog and his works in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Next, Albert interviews Transition Towns founder Rob Hopkins for Radio EcoShock.
My name is Rob Hopkins from Transition Network and from the beautiful Devon town of Totnes, which is one of the founding stones of the transition movement.
Great. Well, first off, I just took a tour around Totnes. I went to the Atmos Center and I was totally enamored, not so much by the project. I've seen urban brown space redevelopment kinds of things. What impressed me was the process. Mm. And you've set aside a part of this brownfield site as a museum to the process, even before it's gone very far. And being able to walk through year by year, day by day, you know, who's been to which event, it really shows social permaculture in such an elegant way. That's one of the finer features of having a history, having a way of keeping up. Okay, so a few questions. One is, you've got four children. You hear a lot about climate change. You think about their future. You're tuned in to the latest scientific reports all the time. Surely there must come moments when it seems very dark. How do you think about the future? Do you have hope? And if so, why?
I think like everybody, and I always come back, that thing Paul Hawkins said about if you're not optimist and you haven't read this climate science properly, go back and read it again. And if you're a pessimist, then you haven't spent any time among the movement of people doing something about it. I kind of inhabit that space and I try not to get attached to whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist, because I don't think there's much value in either, really. You sort of shut down and it's really, for me, part of the, it's like AC/DC, you know, part of the energy that drives me is that flipping back and forth between the two things. And, you know, I think we all have to make space for those moments where you think, this is just awful. But then at the same time, you know, I'm in a very kind of privileged position of meeting and visiting lots of transition groups doing phenomenal stuff all over the place. And seeing, you know, I mean, something like the Atmos project that you mentioned for me is an incredible example of taking this to places that's not expected of it. There's a Jean de Buffet, who was a French artist, used to say, art's best moments are when it forgets what it's called. And so for me, permaculture and transition's best moments are when it moves outside what's kind of expected of it, you know? And I loved that. I remember a really key moment for me in 2012 in Totnes was we ran a campaign to stop. You know, we're a town where 80% of our high street is small independent businesses. And that in the UK now is a precious, precious thing. Very few, most places it's the other way around. And for us, that resilience is the foundation that we build the new economy off, not something that's expendable. We have 40 places in our town where you can buy a cup of coffee from an independently owned business. And Costa Coffee, who are a massive, like the British Starbucks, wanted to open an outlet in a big unit at the bottom of the town where all the tourists come. The first place they would come to off the bus, Costa. They recognize it. Great, let's go into Costa. You know, a third of our coffee shops up the high street just die, and that's local families. So we ran a campaign that wasn't really anti-Costa. It was pro what we love about our town and about its culture and why that's so precious. The amazing thing was, you know, I've been, since I was 16, involved in campaigning on different things about nuclear and roads building and Iraq war and this, that and the other. Never won anything. I realized at the time, actually, I've spent so many years of my life campaigning and protesting and lost all of them. And actually, and that's my default expectation, is you make a lot of noise and you lose. And a lot of other people's expectation from outside is, people like you make a lot of noise and then you lose everything and everything carries on as it is and that's just fine. And actually, we won the Costa. Costa decided they wouldn't come. And what was really interesting was, firstly, for me, and a lot of us, that experience of, ooh, this is a funny feeling. I'm not used to this. But also other people who were like, who didn't feel that they knew, who wanted a cost, who didn't feel they needed to make a noise about it, because you lot always lose. And all of a sudden, well, we actually quite wanted a costa, actually. And so I guess for me, you know, more and more, I mean, with things like Atmos and with incredible things happening like that, I mean, the Bristol Pound, these big sort of local currency schemes going on. You know, there's now £13 million in this country invested in community energy raised through transition energy companies. Massive kind of impacts now when we're starting to measure them. Actually, we need to start getting used to the feeling of actually doing well at this stuff and winning. And, you know, Marianne Williamson had that thing about, you know, what we feel is our own brilliance or whatever. I think we're at that point. And that's that sense of this is starting to shift and actually we're starting to win some of these things, for me, is one of the things that helps me overcome those dark moments.
You have a new book that's coming out that captures some of these successes. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, in December in Paris, it's COP21, where all the world leaders come together, hopefully, and reach some sort of agreement that is what we need to see. You know, what we saw in Copenhagen was that everybody put in all that Copenhagen rubbish, you know, that actually everybody then, when it didn't happen, I mean, it kind of kicked the climate change movement in the knackers for about 4 years. We only just sort of got back up off the floor again in the last couple of years, you know. And where was that?
Copenhagen was a bust.
So for us, actually, we felt that what we needed to do was something that was a celebration and that kind of said, do you know what, regardless of what you decide to do, there's something really amazing going on here, and we're going to celebrate that. And you need to hear about that, because actually all over the world, in thousands and thousands of places, people are living in the way that we need to live if we successfully are able to avoid the worst excesses of climate change. And they're having a better time. They're creating jobs. They're pulling their local economies together. They're doing all sorts of amazing things.
Name of the book?
The name of the book is going to be called 21 Transition Stories for COP21. We invited transition groups around the world to send in their stories. We chose 21. They're incredibly diverse, from 15 countries, 39 transition groups. We pulled out lots of really amazing hard data. You know, there's that collectively those stories have saved, have reduced car travel, the distance of driving to the moon and back twice. They're generating enough electricity for 36,000 homes. They've raised £13 million worth of investment into local renewable energy. They're supporting hundreds of farms. I mean, it's really, but also you then get across the message, and that's just the stuff they measured. You know, we look at, often people would come to something like transition, how much carbon has it saved? Well, that's an important question. But nobody really asks, well, how many of our volunteer hours have you generated? We've got 21 stories in there. They've generated 15,000 hours of community engagement. That's 21 stories. You think over the last 10 years, if every transition group had measured the number of volunteer hours it had generated and then put like a monetary value to that, I mean, it's awesome, you know. And so those are the stories that we felt we needed to take to COP, to celebrate, to say, do you know what, you do what you do, but actually this is phenomenal that this thing is happening and you could be part of it. And so that's what we're doing. So it's going to be called 21 Stories for COP21. It'll be coming out at the beginning of November. There will also be an e-book, and there'll be lots of other stuff that will be designed off the back of that.
Last question. If you had one wish, if you had one thing that a fairy godmother came and gave you for you to help you personally with your work, have any idea what that might be?
Well, I think the first answer to that question is in many ways, I think the fairy godmother already came. Because we set up Transition Network. It's an organization of about 12 people. We're in the fortunate position where, I mean, it's hand to mouth, but, you know, we are able to have that team of people working there. Incredible. You know, this event here has been pulled together by those 12 people who work together in a way of with a depth of respect and trust and working that is really phenomenal. So in some ways, my fairy godmother already came. It would be, and again, this is the second one, has actually already happened as well, is about communications. Mm. You know, if you look at it, like we have people who are comms professionals who work in organizations whose job is to take an organization that doesn't really do very much and generate it and make it look like they're awesome and they're doing all this fantastic stuff. And actually, it's not that great. And they get really disillusioned with, God, I'm having to paint this little thing to be fantastic. I mean, actually, comms people come to us and they're like, transition is incredible. Look at all these stores. You've got this city doing this. You've got this. You've got this. You've got this. And so, but we've always struggled with the capacity to really get those stories out. So we now have somebody. So the fairy godmother has come twice, and she just started the other day. So we're going into doing this stuff around COP with a brilliant comms professional, and I think that's really going to help. So she's my fairy
godmother. So she comes the third time. What's the fairy godmother going to bring you that time?
What would she mean the third time? I think she would bring... One of the big challenges we have with projects like Atmos, which in many ways represent the next evolutionary step, I think, for transition, which is about, okay, if we're serious about this, if you bring an entrepreneur's brain to these challenges, how do they look at this stuff? You know, if you... And is it possible that a transition group that's just meeting on its Wednesday evenings once a month, once it's got the kids to bed, is going to be able to produce the change on the scale we need? And so the thing with Atmos is about, we need to own assets. As a community, we need to own buildings, we need to own land, rather than depending on grants and handouts and stuff. Actually, if we own assets that are generating revenue, then we can really make this shit happen in a really scaling up kind of a way. The challenge with that is kind of pre-development finance. So with something like Atmos, that's going to be like a 60, 70 million pound development. It's going to cost us about £600,000 to get up to getting the planning consent, but that's all at risk because we may not get the planning consent. You know, so we have some amazing kind of angels and funders who've come in, and we're part of the way there. But I think the fairy godmother would recognise that it needs to be at risk. We need as part of the divestment movement, you know, what you were saying earlier, it's about reinvestment. Actually, we need that money to come in and say, there is the most awesome opportunity here to shift energy, to shift development, to shift food, to shift all these things to the community scale. But that's not a level playing field. They need support. They need investment done in a different way. That's what I'd ask her for.
Thank you very much. Perfect conclusion. Thank you.
That was Rob Hopkins, founder of the Transition Towns Movement. Find out more about Rob in my show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. And you are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the special on permaculture. I'm Alex Smith. We wrap with another speech from the latest International Permaculture Convergence in London, England, last September. Rosemary Murrow started learning about permaculture in Australia in the early 1980s. She's founded branches in Cambodia, Vietnam, and many other places.
Okay. Well, goodness, that's been the theme of the conference in some ways, hasn't it? The good and the difficult. The really, really hard stuff to do. So, just to do a bit of a look at who we are and what we've done, we've been active for nearly 40 years. Very, very short time in life. And we've had some considerable achievements. And we've heard about a lot of those, haven't we? We've heard from Jonathan. We've heard about scaling up. We've heard about waves of permaculture from David. It's really been a rich smorgasbord in this conference. The thing that is on our side that even the Paris talks don't have is that major fact, we are on the side of life. Now, that sounds simple. However, so many of the things that we started with Vala, people are not on the side of life. And I think because we're on the side of life, we're actually garnishing a much greater force than we've been able to say. So I was looking at some of the elements and patterns in permaculture that have helped us achieved so well in such a time. 170 countries, perhaps a million graduates, I don't know, but it's a lot of people. So what I want to talk about is that everyone is part of the solution and no one's part of the problem. So let's look at some of the elements and processes that got us here today, that helped us achieve. Let's see if they're going to last us into the future, and if not, what do we need? So let's build on also our earlier speakers from yesterday and today. Now, what have we got in permaculture? There's a need, there's a wanting. In some cases, there's a great grief But most people, or maybe it'd be interesting to see if human happiness goes down with increased income and use of resources without caring for the earth. Be a very interesting correlation if it existed. It may not, but perhaps the more we use up, the less happier we are. Be good to look at people who live frugally and see if the happiness index goes up. We're going to look at our content, which has been entirely relevant for this new last wave of permaculture that David talked about from the 2002. And then we're going to look at our processes, what we do and why we're so radical. So I just like to take you back to need and how fast some people pick up permaculture. This was in Vietnam at Doi Moi in about 1985. Gosh, I crossed the centuries. I've grown old in permaculture. And so it's a buzz to see so many young ones. It's wonderful, so fabulous. So in late 1980s, when I went to Vietnam, they'd had 30 years of war and 30 million bomb craters. And most of the houses looked like this, and most of the people were as thin as a toothpick. Really, really thin. And the people were hungry, but satisfied that they had achieved some sort of peace in their country. It was a matter of rebuilding, and they knew they couldn't go back because they had 30 years of collectivisation, which, don't tell anyone, they hated collectivisation. But they liked the whole communist socialist government and Ho Chi Minh, but collectivisation, everyone moving out of their village where they lived for hundreds of years and their ancestors were buried, they loathed. They walked away from those brick houses, they left the doors floating in the wind, and they went back to their villages. But 2 million men and women had died. The younger generation didn't know how to farm. They'd had 30 years of growing rice. 15 to 30 kilograms a month was the currency. They really needed to get started again. So there was a great need, and they embraced permaculture. Next thing I want to look at is our content. I love the permaculture content. There's something profoundly beautiful and satisfying about the way it grows in depth and in breadth over the years as you teach it. And I'm easily distractible and bored, and if it weren't like that, I'd be out. What I loved was the permaculture, and in the 30 years I've been teaching it, I have seen it, the evidence come in. You know, when people first started talking about changing the climate, lots of people said, that's ridiculous. You know, 98% nitrogen, so much oxygen, so much moisture, you can't change the climate. In my life, I've seen it change. So I've seen the evidence come in for a permaculture. First of all, the global problems, which were brilliantly done up to date, and then see how permaculture can work with that. And so I have put here just some of the outcomes rather than the course curriculum. I think you know the course curriculum, but the outcomes, you know, if we work well with land and care of the earth, we are all our indices will be on accumulation of natural resources. We will look at how much water we've put back. We'll put at how much soil we've put back, how many species we've managed to save and build up. We will have measurements for the indices of restoration of ecosystems that become the most important thing in our economy. Because without that, no gelato society is going to exist. But we owe it to the future generations. We cannot go on like this. So restore and accumulate water, soil, forests. These must be our indices. Don't let us buy into the economists and the GDP and they won't believe us if we don't do this. They're going to have to believe us and we will have a better alternative, much better, and they'll say, tell us. So let's stay on for life. Let's be the people who love life, support it and want to see it grow. In terms of commerce, economy, we've been having a look at a whole range of things over these workshops, exciting possibilities, fabulous thinkers. Now that's what permaculture's got, right? And then we've got the people, resilient, and engaged. Now, when I started permaculture, the main objective was that everyone would build their own garden. And the first words that David and Bill used to talk about were permanence. And then gradually the word sustainability came in, but of course there's no sustainability unless you've got equal inputs and outputs, and we haven't got to equal inputs to match our outputs, so the word is, what would you call it, unbalanced or something? I don't know. You've got a better way of thinking about it. Okay, and then we're now talking about resilience in case of perturbation. So we've had some changes. We've gone from the individual now to communities, to towns, to cities, to bioregions as our unit, to our watersheds as our unit of work. And in a way, we've dropped that hyper-individuality that was in permaculture in the beginning, and we've really come to a new position where we see ourselves as citizens of groups and members of communities. And I love it. I don't know about you, but it feels so good just to be part of a group, and I think we've had that here today. So when we look at the permaculture curriculum or knowledge that was passed on, is the content going to serve us for a challenging future? Let's see. Can you see it's basically a branching pattern? Well, it's got the managing director up top, and then you've got the executive, and then you've got all the staff people who sign things and do things and say you can and you cannot. And finally, down the bottom, you've got someone else. Which are the people? Us, really. So what we find in that model and that process is that everything new has to go back up to the top. The board will consider that when it meets in a month. The director's not quite happy about it. We don't like that idea. Where did you go to school? What's your qualification? We have been free of that because we've had a different pattern. So let's look at this. What we did, if you don't mind a bit of history, is we started permaculture with Bill and David. And it started to spread because people went out and taught. People like me. I did a course with Robin Francis and I thought, oh, I'm going to have a go at this. And a year later, I was teaching. And I had 8 people in my first class. 2 were over 90. And they would sort of fall off the chair and wake up. One was a radical doctor. One spent a lot of time telling us, since as you grow up and give up singlets, you should also give up knickers. But they were an interesting first class. They came to permaculture. The next classes had something like 18, 20 people, and since then been teaching 2 PDCs a year, sometimes more, in the Blue Mountains where I live. Now, the point about the teachers is we have a long, long history. We teachers have gone to the marketplace, we've gone to the plazas, we've gone to the garages and the carports, we've gone to the villages, and we've taught the way Socrates taught in the marketplace. We've taught the way Jesus taught in the marketplace. Confucius. We have a history of taking our conviction and passion out to where the people are and saying, hey, would you like this? We think it's worthwhile. And so, who set our first curriculum and said you are qualified or not? I'm actually not qualified, I think, to be here today because I haven't been properly diplomed and certified, so it's a bit of an embarrassment. However, I also appreciate the increasing demand for quality of teachers and asking what works. We must find out what the good teachers do, and we will do that not by looking at their syllabus, not by giving them teacher training. We have to look at their graduates. We have to say, how good are the people coming out of that class? Yeah. So, I would love, and I'm advocate, and I'm going to stand here and swear to you, I will defend any system that allows any person who wants to go out and teach permaculture anywhere, because It would be such a shame if we put the brakes on motivation and ability and passion. I will also defend the case it's in universities and TAFEs with a good curriculum to teach those others who appreciate formal education. But I stand with non-formal education of anyone who wants to get out there, do it. Make a film. Talk to your local society. It's yours. So the success of permaculture, see those? We'll have the yellow ones. Can you see the yellow ones? So the yellow ones are the teachers. And the success of teachers in permaculture can never be underestimated. Whether you made models and invited people to come and see, or whether you just took groups of people and gave them certificates. Now, those teachers taught teachers. See the yellow spreading? Who taught teachers? And exponentially, permaculture's moved across the world, really, because of teachers who taught teachers. Now, they didn't all do it with certificates and courses, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, what happened then is some people were the designers and doers, and they did it. And without that, we teachers would have been lost. We had to go home and do it ourselves. We couldn't say, hey, you guys, do this. We can't show you what it looks like, and I haven't actually done it myself, but, you know, my friends say. And then we have the people who settled, and they explored topics. So we had the people who started GEN, the Global Ecological Eco-Village Network. We had the people who started Transition Towns, and we heard from Rob this morning. And they made little nodes that floated off and have become independent. So what we've got is all these progeny of permaculture, and you could name the food forest one. Today in America there's a huge conference on resilient communities, but we're the ones, didn't it? We know about resilient. They've taken it and run with it. So various people grab it and run through permaculture and feed it out there. Then we find economics is becoming a new node. So these people then create their own teachers and their own networks. It's sort of what Vala was saying, we're feeding into everywhere. There seems to be no place in the world that we haven't moved into. If you have a look at those, the schools network, they all have their own conferences. Urban Regeneration has their conferences. It's really creating progeny everywhere. The thing about our process is our pattern is our strength. If we had chosen a world body to control us, not support and resource us, and we haven't got one, we would be still back in Tasmania on the beach or in Daylesford, Victoria. It is because of our nodes and patterns and our freedom and our flexibility. And we must, over the future, stay open and adaptable to new ideas and areas. And you can see that networks accelerate, as our governments know. That's why they don't like networks much. People's movements, the web. You know, I mean, we've got PermaOccupy in Washington and in Barcelona. Well, the node there, easy. The link was the web. I wanted to talk to you about people doing new frontiers, except I'm not going to because I haven't got enough time. But have a look at Naomi Klein meeting up with Liz Bastian at a recent... Can you see what the conference is about? How do you feel about being part of that movement? Yeah. Right. A festival of dangerous ideas. And that's what we've been doing here in many of the workshops. Let's just go quickly to Cambodia, where I want to talk for a couple of minutes about infiltration. You know, a quarter of the population slaughtered by Pol Pot forces... disempowered, thin, hungry, overworked. When I went to Cambodia, it was a disaster. Newly formed government had departments like rural affairs, agriculture, women's affairs, who didn't know what to do. They'd never held those jobs. They had no brief. Their department didn't know. Their government didn't know. It was hopeless. And so when they invited me to do permaculture in Persat, suddenly they had a brief, and we had infiltrated into a government department. That then spread from Persat province to Kompong Chenang to Svadieng to Kandal to Kompot. So I trained the first trainers, and I trained them in permaculture. And then I went back and I monitored. I walked from village to village, monitoring, looking at food, decrease in waste, increase in money. Often just a dollar a week was enough to send a child to school, and a dollar a month would get you enough rice. Tiny increases in people's prosperity, but they could do it themselves. It became a people's movement. So the Department of Women Affairs went out to every village, and they stood there in the dirt and under houses, and they taught people how to do permaculture, but not until they'd done it themselves. So then the people learning had to come and look at the gardens of the trainers. And the whole thing was embedded into in-service training and salaries. Not a new NGO, not a model farm, just right through. Same thing happened in Uganda with Department of Agriculture at Rakai. Same thing happened with the Conso in southwest Ethiopia. It's happened through, to some extent, Permatil in East Timor. It's happened with Custom Gardens in Honiara and the Solomons. So what we do have is putting things in place that already existing and infiltrate and give people that knowledge, which is my second passion, is the right to good, reliable knowledge and evidence. People in the Solomon Islands really couldn't assess whether the ocean was rising or not, or whether they would get another tsunami. Terrible. So what we have done is try to get them information about their situation the way we've had here, but also information on how to move forward. I would like us now to just stop for a moment and think of those thousands, tens of thousands of permaculturists in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in Africa, in India, who can't be here today because they are the farmers on the ground practicing permaculture. If I could, I'd give every single one of them a certificate. They're absolutely worthy, and they are our silent majority of permaculturists. We are the tiny minority. Right? Just a picture. An orphanage in Cambodia, 300 children and 3 adults, 3 tiers deep, bunk beds, corrugated iron roof, bars on the windows. This is the play area. Permaculture there was taken partly by Jan Smart in Washington, and she invited me to go. Within 5 years, those children have an egg 3 times a week. They get bananas, they get papaya, they have full vegetables, and they love gardening. And when I arrived, they hated it. They had them all lined up chipping with a big hoe, a heavy hoe, chipping the weeds. It has transformed. At the same time, the local Department of Agriculture said, we didn't know, when our Director General said you must do sustainability, we didn't know what sustainability was, but now we know. Our Burmese refugees, just doing it. Right? A Lati in the Conso did the course in PDC, and the following Monday he was making seedlings and bringing 18 women every Monday down to his village to learn how to do permaculture, unpaid, unsung, unrecognised, but he loves it because fundamentally we're happy, aren't we? So we are, all of us here, we all do so much more than we ever get paid for. We all belong to that gift economy, which is share surplus. We all, I think, are happier than having those huge amounts of, what was it, the GDP going up and up. I think we're on the happiness scale because what we do matters and it's meaningful to us. This book, I've always been concerned for resources, so I wrote the first book so people would have it at a level because I've got a small sort of brain and I had trouble reading Bill's book and keeping it together, so I wrote an easy one for me and then it got published. And then the second one about teaching is for teachers who want good material and it's thoroughly resourced. And this is for teaching permaculture teachers. And I wanted to do it because I wanted us to teach with a sense of care of people. not as curriculum, but as process. Treat people well. Listen to them. Listen to their opinions, hear what they've got to say. So that is free online to any of you here, I think, because I haven't looked. But it was crowdfunders who gave that. And it was crowdfunders who sent Paula Parnanen with John Battalabasi right now to Solomon Islands to help the people get ready because they'll have to move. It was the crowdfunding, which is part of a gift economy. Okay, right. Where to next? These are the places I think you are needed, and I think you're vitally needed. If our cities have 5 billion people by 2050, how good are we to offer cities fabulous resources? I don't think we're there. But permaculture shows we can be there, and very quickly. We have more than 30 years to skill up and get good at cities. We've got lots of strategies. We've got lots of techniques. We can look to Hong Kong with their brilliant small-scale work. We can look to the roof gardens and the balcony farmers. We've got lots. We just need to put it together. Refugees. Well, look, I'd be stoked if we could develop a lovely way to work with people who are going into camps. I've worked in refugee camps in the past, and they see the need for permaculture. And yet, they're resourceful, they've got lives, they've got grateful to be there. They are some of the most wonderful people you'll ever meet. A friend of mine was in deep depression till he started to work with refugees, and he said, this is great. Not because he was helping, but because of what they give to us. It's a great generosity of refugees. So Karen, who's in the last course, lives in Spain, and she said, oh, I want to go to developing countries and I want to do what you do. I said, well, the developing countries are coming here, and so are the developed countries. And she said, well, I could go down to the coast, not far from our ecosystem, and see if people want to come up here and look and talk to us and share their skills. But go for it, Karen. You know, go for it. No qualification, no world body, no one's going to send you there. So how will we do it? I think you can answer these questions. Accelerate the succession. We've got one example from India. We had a fabulous example this morning for the UGEN, how to use mass media and mass movements and get it right. We have to move into the future with more visuals. That puts me out. We have to establish quality of trainees. We have to enable, adapt. Right, I've finished with this. In Kabul, where the war has gone now since 1978, there's a group of young people called the Afghan Peace Volunteers. And they're 50 people, mainly orphans and internal refugees, living in a little house. And they got in touch with me and said, we want to learn permaculture. Now, they had no land, and they had nothing to teach them and no books. And Kabul is being bombed. And so this is the rooftop of a girls' hostel, and we've been meeting when we can, because there's no reliable web access, on Skype, and a couple of them have actually died in the time since we started through landmines, bombs. They live probably in fear, like people in Syria, and they said, we'll do a garden. And it's a beautiful permaculture garden. They said, enough war, our journey to peace. We want permaculture. They're seeking support. So 50 young Afghanis, partly permaculturalists, are saying they're going to stop war in the world. Takes some getting your head round. They haven't got anything, no families, no resources. They just believe it's enough. So if they can, you can. Thank you.
That was Rosemary Murrow. This speech was recorded at the 15th Annual International Permaculture Convergence in London, 2015. My thanks to Albert Bates for his talk, interview, and guidance in assembling this program. We'll have more to come next week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and for caring about our world.
The Taylor Report. By the way, write to us, Taylor at CIUT 89.5. Taylor at CIUT.fm. And we're going to be speaking to Chris Black. We've got to juggle our list. And Chris Black has written a very important article about this. Chris, I should tell you, practices international law, knows wherever he speaks. And he points out that the U.S. has been following a policy on Syria which it goes unquestioned, but its practice is to ignore international law when it applies to themselves and to simply say that they make the rules. And, for example, establishing a blockade of Syria, and he points out that this blockade involves humanitarian aid. They talk about humanitarian aid for Syrian refugees who have left Syria, but Syria has internal refugees and needs help. And that is blocked. U.S. is not interested in helping those people who are in Syria. I think we're joined by Chris Black.
Right. How are you doing?
Very good. I'm glad to be – we reached you. And don't mind my mobile phone. We work while we're broadcasting. Chris, I was just saying that you've written an important piece about this blockade of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And you point out that the U.S. is actually violating international law.
Right.
This isn't coming up at the U.N. Instead, we have President Obama talking about his terms for resolving this, what he calls the Syria crisis, mm-hmm. and lecturing, Mr. Putin. But in fact, what U.S. policy is on Syria is criminal. You want to make that case?
Yeah, because everybody's quite clear that the United States and its allies, Saudi Arabia and Qatar and France and Britain, are supporting these groups which are attacking the government of Syria and causing all this misery and chaos and all these refugees. That's quite clear.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they claim a justification for it. Obama repeated it again today in his speech to the General Assembly that Assad has to go,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. And
by the way,
President Putin said no.
Isn't that itself illegal, really, to call for the
right.
removal of a sitting president of a sovereign
yes.
state, a full member of the United
right.
Nations?
Yeah, with a Syrian ambassador sitting there.
Yes.
Yeah, that shows how contemptuous they are of the UN itself. I mean, he even justified the use of sanctions, which is banned by the UN Charter. He is bragging about the effect on Russia of those sanctions, and saying yet that he follows the UN Charter, but that's in violation of the UN Charter. The hypocrisy was incredible yeah. in that speech. But the Russians, of course, reaffirmed that they're going to support the Syrian government as much as they can. But the illegality goes not only from supporting – it's a war crime to support armed groups in a different country – which were attacking a legitimate government, because that's a war crime, or even to send them in.
Mm-hmm.
And they let it be known their special forces are operating with these groups as well. Mm-hmm. So they're directly involved. And dropping supplies. So then the event that got me or what provoked me to write that article was seeing this story about Obama requesting Greece and Bulgaria to stop the flow of relief supplies to mm-hmm. from Russia to there.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed... and it was just... said in the press, but there was no comment on the fact that, that's a war crime to do that.
Yeah.
So I just wrote the article because it made me angry that nobody was picking up that was the case.
You really put your finger on an important matter. This, by the way, this is Chris Black. The article is U.S. Blockade of Syria, a War Crime, and it's journal-neo.org. That's the New Eastern Outlook.
Right.
And actually, when I read that item, and I'm so glad you wrote the piece, because that act is a sort of thing that does precipitate wars. U.S.
Right.
has no such authority, and if the Russia exercises its rights, you could have some pretty heavy problems.
That's correct. And luckily, Greece turned it down, but Bulgaria accepted. I understand the Russians have arranged to fly through Iran, south of there, to come through instead. But or they can still fly over Greece, I understand. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the Americans asked for that, for Syria effectively to be blockaded from Russian relief supplies, is a crime, because I mean, they alleged, well, maybe they're using those flights to bring in weapons. Well, so what? They're allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. But they were, in fact, bringing in also relief supplies. Mm-hmm. And the Americans said, we don't care. They can't bring in relief supplies. And yet they're dropping supplies to these terrorists. So yeah. To do that is under the Rome Statutes, a war crime. It's always been considered a war crime. But basically they want to do it to make the lives of the people of Syria in complete misery.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course Canada has jumped into this, and this has blocked, or rather closed embassies, which is a way to delegitimize the government.
Right.
When you do that, you say no more international relations with them, and the Syrian nationals living in Canada cannot get the necessary assistance they need to be in touch with families or to do trade, anything.
Right.
That's part and parcel of aggression against the sovereign government of Syria.
Yes, and driving... driving all these refugees into Europe, which provokes a reaction in Europe, and obviously they're using that reaction to try and justify another attack on Assad. I mean, it's quite clear that the American-European aim is still there to get rid of Assad one way or the other, mm-hmm. and Russia sees that, so they've stepped up. Well, they seem to have drawn a line there, but...
Doesn't all this go back to 2013 when they were absolutely on the brink?
Yeah,
and they said they were going to do it.
Right.
And two things extraordinary happened. One was Russia said, you don't have the authority of the Security Council, and we're against this.
Yeah.
And the British Parliament.
Yeah, the British Parliament vote was extraordinary, yeah.
And now, by the way, on that, they had their Jeremy Corbyn moment when mm-hmm. they – it may tell us something about how the U.S. is viewed, even by its rather intimate friends.
Exactly. But the government here, I mean, our government supports all these. I haven't heard any of the opposition parties. Maybe Mulcair doesn't like the Middle East situation, but generally they support these NATO actions.
He's not sure why.
Yeah, I'm not sure why. And generally they support all these NATO, because they're NATO operations, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But... Yeah, the criminality is, and then Obama said today that though he supports the UN, he says the United States has the right to help oppress peoples wherever there's tyranny, despite that there's no such thing as national sovereignty. That we will alone, or people willing to go with us, we will do what we want.
You practice international law and actually an authority on the matter, and does he have any such?
No,
who gave him that right?
You can't. Is it
divine? We're going to talk about the Pope later, so we'll be fine. Right. We'll get the real authority on this.
Yeah. No, it's just naked power talking the way naked power does. It's surprising when you watch Obama's speech. He was like some, maybe it's flip to say, but it's like some punk kid strutting on the street saying, I've got the big gun, so you do what I tell you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people saying, well, what about the cops? Well, yeah, what cops? Mm-hmm. I'm the cop. that's why he's acting. And then
yes, it's kind of like in the gangster movie where the guy says,
right.
Hey, somebody call a cop, and the other gangster says, I am a cop.
Yeah, exactly. Then we have President. I saw the President of China's speech, very reasonable, talking about win-win situations, and very positive, almost zen-like. And then Putin was actually quite restrained. I was expecting... more fire from him, really, but
he
came across very statesmanlike and said, you know, we adhere to international law, none of this is acceptable. You know, and he made an important statement, though. He said, it struck me, he said, Russia will no longer tolerate this behavior, something like that.
Well, it is very true, and I'd like your comment on it, but you could say they have a duty. I mean, after all, they have relations entirely legal and proper with the Syrian government.
Correct.
And for them to renege on those responsibilities would really be bending the knee to an aggressor.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, that's the way they're working it. Because in his speech today, Obama threatened, he managed to threaten everybody at once. He threatened Russia for its aggression, so-called, in Ukraine, China for its aggression in the South China Sea, Iran for sponsoring terrorist groups, and Cuba, the people of Cuba were to blame for the embargo he had to impose on them because they wouldn't cooperate.
Did he say that?
Something to that effect, yeah. Basically, yes, what he said. Yeah. It was astounding. But that's,
it is astounding, and it's a very dangerous moment. Chris Black is the author of U.S. Blockade of Syria, a War Crime. It's a September 24, journal-neo.org. And just lastly, Chris, you, of course, followed this closely. You watched the events unfold in Libya, which proved to be sort of the dry run for what seems to be going on in Syria. I remember that the U.S. said, oh, the peaceful demonstrators of in eastern Libya have been attacked by Gaddafi's people.
Right.
There is a mantra that they go through. They always say there was peaceful demonstrations in Syria, and then it turned violent because of the army.
Yeah.
Who proved that? All of a sudden, after that one weekend of so-called demonstrations, really professional armed groups were unleashed against Syria.
Yeah, and it was the same in Libya. The groups that rose up were armed to begin with and attacked the police to begin with, and it wasn't the other way around. And, of course, when you see in Ukraine, the Ukrainian government attacks its own people when they protest illegitimate government moves, and they use weapons and planes and jets and tanks and white phosphorus bombs on their own people, there's no call to oust the Poroshenko regime. Yes. They support them.
Well, as a matter of
fact, the hypocrisy is revealed right there.
Right. In both instances, General Petraeus said we should arm both of those.
Correct. Yeah. Right. Whereas when Gaddafi did that, well, he had to be overthrown. And Assad does that, they say he has to be overthrown. Poroshenko does that, well, that's fine.
He has to be armed.
In fact, we'll help him.
Well, Chris, you've written a great article. It's a U.S. blockade of Syria war crime. We're glad you could take the time. It's journal-neo.org. And look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay. You're welcome. Take care.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Bye. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Maya Katz and Suleiman Khatib, Israeli and Palestinian members of the group Combatants for Peace, who talk about the recent spike of violence in Israel and Palestine. Jessup Bonner of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who explains why a broad coalition is opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement and the next steps in the campaign to defeat the pact in the U.S. Congress. And Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who discusses a recently published report that reveals U.S.-based multinational corporations shelter $2.1 trillion in offshore accounts, avoiding $620 billion in federal taxes. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since the fall of the apartheid government in South Africa, economic inequality has surged, creating a massive wealth gap between blacks and whites. Rising inequality, by some measures, worse now than when the apartheid system fell, is also linked to a spike in violent crime. French economist Thomas Piketty, author of Capital in the 21st Century, delivering the annual Nelson Mandela Lecture at the University of Johannesburg's Soweto campus in early October, stated that two-thirds of South Africa's wealth is controlled by the top 10% of the population, which is overwhelmingly white. Piketty called for South Africa's leaders to push for a higher minimum wage in the face of double-digit unemployment and endorse new ambitious land reform programs. The French economist also called for moving away from the market-based reforms of the last decade, which he asserted failed to redistribute wealth. Inequality in South Africa is increasingly linked with rising violent crime and attacks by gangs terrorizing poor communities, where 50 people on average are murdered every day. As Eusebius McKeyser, a South African author and newspaper columnist, observed, "We've known for years there is a reliable correlation between gratuitously violent crime and inequality. Poverty, unemployment, and social cohesion are all part of the mix, but we are deeply unequal still, so the statistics don't surprise me." In the late 1990s, heavily Catholic El Salvador enacted a penal law that outlawed nearly all abortions, including when the life of a pregnant mother is at risk. Over the years, the law has been aggressively enforced, and a woman convicted of having an abortion could face 50 years in jail. According to The Nation magazine, currently 17 women sit in jail without any chance of an appeal for having a miscarriage or stillbirth. They were all convicted of aggravated homicide on highly dubious evidence. Advocates for the women, known as the 17 or Las 17, are seeking pardons for the imprisoned women. Ironically, health professionals, out of fear or caution, have reported the majority of the miscarriage cases to the police. Critics say hospital doctors, fearful of violating the draconian anti-abortion law, blame pregnant women when they arrive at the hospital hemorrhaging. Salvadoran authorities regularly use antiquated tests to argue, without valid evidence, that babies who died were born alive. The Las 17 women are jailed in the Ilopango prison, which is reportedly more than 900% over capacity. The political climate in El Salvador, even with a left-leaning president, is such that progressive politicians are finding it difficult to speak out in support of the 17, fearing retaliation in the next election. Conditions in a Google Express warehouse in Palo Alto, California, are a far cry from the fun campus environment that has attracted many young computer programmers to the internet giant. The staffing company, Adecco, that hires the workers, imposes a 2-year cap on employment and tolerates poor working conditions. Increasingly, workers are taking action against poor pay and dangerous working conditions in the back office operations at top tech corporations like Google, Apple, and eBay. To snuff out a union drive in Palo Alto, Adecco hired anti-labor management consultant Jackson Lewis. Yet the intimidation tactics failed as the workers voted to join the Teamsters Union in August. According to the news magazine In These Times, the union mobilization of back-office tech workers started when Reverend Jesse Jackson launched a public campaign to expose race and class division in Silicon Valley. The veteran civil rights leader supported a union drive by security guards at semiconductor maker Broadcom. Thus far, in 2015, the Teamsters have won 4 union campaigns in Silicon Valley, including 2 transport companies that serve Yahoo, Apple, and eBay. The Service Employees International Union has also initiated an organizing drive among two of the largest security staffing firms in California's high-tech valley. The union campaigns now underway in one of the nation's most lucrative industries are a test case for whether or not profits will be shared in the 21st century. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Since mid-September, 8 Israelis have been killed and 75 have been wounded in knife attacks carried out by Palestinians. During the month of October thus far, 45 Palestinians have been shot to death by the Israeli army and civilians in the West Bank, Jerusalem, and Gaza. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, more than 1,800 others have been wounded by live ammunition, rubber bullets, and beatings. Much of the violence is centered around Jerusalem, where a dispute has escalated over access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Dome of the Rock, Muslim holy sites near the Temple Mount, one of the holiest sites in Judaism. People living in the region are on edge, and there is talk of a third Palestinian intifada or uprising against Israeli occupation. As violence has escalated in Israel and Palestine, a group of former Israeli soldiers and former Palestinian fighters, known as Combatants for Peace, have been advocating a nonviolent path to end the conflict. The group was founded in 2006 following a very difficult process of trust building. In recent weeks, a small contingent of the group has been traveling throughout the U.S. that includes Suleiman Khatib, a founder of Combatants for Peace, who spent 10 years in an Israeli prison beginning at age 14 for violently opposing the Israeli occupation. Another combatant traveling in the U.S. is Maya Katz, who grew up on an Israeli kibbutz. She was present at the rally on November 4, 1995, when Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, a moment she says changed her life. She later enlisted in the Israeli army, but after her discharge, she joined Combatants for Peace. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with the pair before a recent public event in Connecticut. Here they address the current spike in violence between Israelis and Palestinians, and address the question of whether a two-state solution is still viable.
I think that, unfortunately, the situation in the West Bank and also inside of Israel is getting worse. And the two peoples are really frustrated from the situation right now, where there is no solution and no conversation between Israel and Palestine. And what we see now is a huge frustration, mainly from the Palestinian side, and we can see a lot of clashes between ordinary people, between Israelis and Palestinians, while as before we could see mainly clashes between Palestinians and the IDF soldiers, now we can see a lot of riots and fights in the streets between ordinary people, between Palestinian youth and Israeli people. And I think this is a bit different. And actually, I'm a bit worried. I think that we in Combatants for Peace always show that there is another way. And even in times like this, where the two peoples are fighting each other, we try to offer an alternative. So Palestinians and Israelis in Combatants for Peace, all every day on the ground, on the streets, demonstrating, meeting each other and offering the public another way of dialogue, and also another way to imagine that there is another option to end this conflict.
Basically, the violence was expected due to the fact there were no hope. There was no hope. There is no negotiation, especially for the Palestinians. There is no hope. And we will see a growing number of settlements in the Palestinian territory. So basically, if you ask many Palestinians, the majority, like, they don't feel any hope with the current Israeli right-wing government. That's the truth. At the end of the day, there is no military solution for this conflict, not from the Palestinian side, not from the Israeli side. And that's what we in Combatants for Peace, as ex-fighters, ex-soldiers, ex-officers, that's what we say. That's what we experience ourselves. Unfortunately, unfortunately, not everybody believes what you're saying, but that's what we try all the time to influence people.
Maya Katz and then Suleiman Khatib, please share your views about whether you think a two-state solution is still possible. Do you think a one-state solution is possible?
The official statement of Combatants for Peace that we is that we believe in two-state solution. But as time goes by, the reality is changing, and there are more and more new settlements in the West Bank. So the two populations are really mixed together. So maybe the two-state solution won't be available in the near future. So we in Combatants for Peace, we try always to think about other options. So as we say it right now, we believe in two-state solution or any other just solution that will bring Palestinians freedom and Israelis the safety and the freedom that they need.
Combatants for Peace, when it started in 2005-2006, we did have agreement that we will support two-state solution, the majority of our members. But due to the growing of the settlements, which has really prevented any kind of a state, so the situation changed. And now we have different members that they think differently, and we in Combatants for Peace have a space for different opinions. And so simply we will support, that's what we agree, we'll support any just peaceful solution between the Palestinians and Israelis. We work more on a grassroots level. We don't do negotiation. We try to mobilize people into a joint binational nonviolence actions and meetings and dialogue and also activism on the ground in order to make real change. And we have to do it with other organizations and cooperation with other people. We can't do it alone. But we believe in our, to imagine a different reality in our area. And we're trying our maximum to make progress and to make change. And at the end of the day, what we try to do basically is to find a place for the two narratives to coexist together, next to each other. And I believe personally, if both sides recognize the narrative of each side with all the pain that comes with that, I am aware of that, the practical solutions will be much easier.
That was Maya Katz and Suleiman Khatib, Israeli and Palestinian members of Combatants for Peace. For more information about the group's mission and work, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On October 5th, the U.S. and 11 other nations concluded negotiations on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement that's designed to integrate 40% of the world's economy. The TPP, as it's known, must still be voted on by the U.S. Congress, where a broad coalition of labor, environmental, and consumer groups are working to defeat the controversial trade deal. While the final text of the agreement has not yet been made public, President Obama has maintained from the beginning of the negotiating process that the pact will include the strongest labor protections of any free trade agreement in history. But opponents who have seen leaked text of the agreement's provisions maintain that approval of the TPP will result in job loss, lower wages, and higher prices of pharmaceutical drugs. The divisive investor-state dispute settlement provisions of the TPP allow multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. Those claims would be adjudicated by unaccountable tribunals organized under the World Bank or the United Nations. Your reporter spoke with Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who explains why a growing coalition is opposed to the TPP and the next steps in the campaign to defeat the trade deal in Congress.
It's unclear exactly how final the deal is. We still don't know what's in the text. It hasn't been released. And President Obama has not actually yet announced to Congress of his intent to sign the agreement. But a big part, as I mentioned, of the reason they haven't been able to finish is because there's a lot of opposition to the deal. And a lot of the opposition stems from the fact that even though the TPP is billed as a free trade agreement, it's really about way more than what we think of when we think of typical trade issues such as tariffs and taxes on goods, et cetera. And actually, the vast majority of the TPP's contents really don't have anything to do with trade, and they have implications for a number of really important issues for citizens, such as, for example, the cost of medicines, you know, whether or not the environment is protected, labor issues, food safety, rollback of popular procurement programs, et cetera, among many other things. And it's also, the agreement has also garnered a lot of opposition because it's been negotiated completely in secret, and there's been no access for civil society and the press.
Would you address for our listeners some of the concerns that surround pharmaceutical intellectual property and the possibility that we'll see a spike in prices for basic medicines that people need to take?
This part of the negotiations, it's known as it's in the intellectual property chapter. And negotiations about the intellectual property chapter have turned out to be the biggest sticking point in the negotiations. Specifically, as you mentioned, the issue of the expansion of monopoly protections for big pharmaceutical companies. And this would actually increase the price of life-saving medicines because it would be expanding the length of patent terms. So basically blocking competition from a generic version of medicines and allowing these big companies to charge, you know, whatever they want. And more specifically, what's been a huge, huge controversy in this agreement is the monopoly periods for biological medicines. So these are medical products that are actually derived from living organisms, and they're what are used to treat cancer. So we're talking about, you know, people who really, really need these medications and concerns about what the price of these life-saving medicines are going to be. And these increased drug prices also undermine other programs that are really important to try to keep medicine prices down in the U.S., such as Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration program. I mean, this could mean increased costs for programs like PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, et cetera. So this is, you know, something that we don't typically think of as being part of a trade agreement, and it's really a life or death issue, you know, for a lot of people around the world. So that's definitely been one of the biggest controversies in the TPP.
Well, Jessa, lay out for our audience, if you would, the campaign underway now to defeat TPP in the U.S. Congress. There's limited time for debate, and no amendments are permitted under the fast-track provisions that were adopted by Congress several months back.
So the thing about the TPP is that, you know, it really can't become a reality unless it gets through U.S. Congress. And really, the TPP's fate in Congress is highly uncertain, and it's going to be a huge fight. And we saw a preview of this, as you mentioned, during the fast-track fight earlier this year. So fast-track, as you mentioned, the provision which really limits Congress's role in the matters of trade and makes it so that they can't make any changes. They have limited time for debate. They can only vote up or down. So that just barely eked through the Congress. There was a huge, huge coalition of organizations talking about all the major labor unions, environmental groups, human rights groups, faith groups, people concerned about access to medicines and internet freedoms, a number of local groups down to the, you know, some of the huge, huge groups were working together to fight against the fast track. And it was a very, very close fight, but actually, now those organizations that were working on that issue have turned their attention to the TPP and are working to defeat the TPP. So under fast track, Obama has to give 90 days notice before Congress can vote on the TPP. So the very earliest that the TPP could come to Congress would be in early 2016, which is right in the middle of the election season. And, you know, we don't expect that members of Congress are really going to want to take such a controversial vote during the election season. In another kind of demonstration of how politically toxic this issue is, a number of presidential candidates are coming out against the TPP, most notably Hillary Clinton. After supporting the TPP as Secretary of State, has come out against the TPP, also Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, and some other Republican presidential candidates expressing kind of skepticism as well. So it's very, very clear that there's going to be a huge fight, and the TPP's fate really is uncertain in the U.S. Congress. So, I mean, it's really important for people that are, you know, concerned about the TPP. The fight is far, far from over. It's really important for everyone to contact their elected officials and just let them know that they should oppose the TPP.
That was Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more news and commentary on the battle to defeat the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since well before Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, Republican and conservative politicians have railed against corporate taxes, arguing that U.S. tax rates hurt the American economy and put a damper on the creation of jobs. By statute, profitable corporations are supposed to pay a 35% federal income tax rate on their U.S. profits. But in 2010, corporations based in the U.S. had an effective federal tax rate of just 13% on their worldwide income, 17% when state and local taxes are included. Corporations are paying a smaller share of federal tax revenue now than they did in the 1950s, dropping from one-third then to only one-tenth of the total today. Meanwhile, corporate lobbyists are stalking the halls of Congress, advocating legislation that would lower the U.S. corporate income tax rate from the current 35% to 25%, leaving middle-income taxpayers to make up the difference in lost revenue. Now, a new study published by Citizens for Tax Justice and the U.S. Public Interest Research Group Education Fund, titled Offshore Shell Games 2015, reveals that nearly three-quarters of U.S.-based Fortune 500 companies transferred $2.1 trillion in profits to offshore tax havens in 2014. By offshoring their profits, these companies avoided paying an estimated $620 billion in federal taxes if they were subject to paying the full rate. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Gardner, executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a contributor to the report, who summarizes the findings and urges Congress to take action on tax reform measures to ensure corporations pay their fair share of taxes.
The basic idea of the report, the question we're trying to answer, is we know that there are headlines of big companies avoiding taxes by shifting their profits offshore. And we wanted to take a look at how widespread this is. So we looked at the Fortune 500 overall, looked at the annual financial reports, and what we found is that the vast majority of Fortune 500 corporations are now holding subsidiaries in known foreign tax havens. We take this as an indicator that offshoring of profits, sending profits out of the U.S. into beach island tax havens like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, is not only growing, but it's near and universal among multinational corporations. Everybody does it.
Could you give us some examples of the major multinational corporations based here in the United States and the kinds of money we're talking about that they squirrel away overseas and do not pay into the federal tax coffers?
Sure. I'll start with the big picture. We know that these companies, Fortune 500 overall, have disclosed having $2.1 trillion in cash that they're stashing offshore and that they claim they're never bringing back. There may be more. That's just what they've disclosed. The single biggest company on this list is Apple, which says that it has $180 billion in offshore cash. That's the top of the list. You have companies like American Express, Nike, Pfizer, Morgan Stanley, Pepsi. And what you can hear just from that list is that this isn't—it's not a tech sector problem. It's not a bank problem. It's something that virtually everyone in every economic sector is now dabbling in. So there's an awful lot of money at stake. One thing that's striking is how heavily concentrated these profits are in the hands of a small number of corporations. As I said, Apple, you know, you're looking at something like 10% of the entire offshore stash right there. Pfizer, American Express, these few drug companies really are a pretty big chunk of the total as well. So while a lot of the people are doing it, a very small group of the very biggest corporations are the ones who are really benefiting the most from this.
Tax avoidance is not a zero-sum game. Somebody's got to pay the negative fallout, right? Explain to our audience who pays the price for the corporate tax avoidance in terms of the revenues that are missing from federal coffers.
It's a great question, and it's a great question to start with, I think, because I think part of the reason why lawmakers fall prey to this idea that we have to cut corporate taxes is because they're sold this argument that corporate tax cuts are free, that they will pay for themselves. In fact, they don't. After decades, there's no evidence at all that cutting any taxes, let alone corporate taxes, results in economic benefits that offset the revenue loss, you got to pay for them. And when you have a system in place where it's the biggest multinationals that are reaping all these benefits from tax avoidance, inevitably that means one of two things has to happen in order to approach balancing our federal budgets. One is we could hike taxes on everybody else. Everybody else means small businesses that don't have the luxury of hiring expensive lobbyists to get these tax breaks enacted, and that don't have high-profile accountants to help them shift their profits offshore. And of course, the other possibility is people like us, middle-income families, low-income working families. These are the folks who, in the end, are holding the bag when these big multinationals avoid hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes.
Matt, there is a way forward for Congress to take action to rein in this widespread corporate tax avoidance. Lay out for us the political will that will be necessary to move legislation forward to end the incentives for corporate offshore depositing of these large sums of money, and also to get that money back into the United States.
What could allow Congress to have the political will is that the politics are absolutely on the side of revenue-raising reform. If you ask people what makes them most angry about the tax system, they're not mad that their taxes are too high. They're not mad about the way they deal with the tax system. They're mad because they perceive correctly that corporations, that the best-off individuals are getting away with it, that they're not paying their fair share, and that they're shifting their tax load, these corporations, onto the rest of us. That's what makes people mad. And they're furious about the notion that General Electric can earn $4 billion a year and not pay any income taxes on it at all. They're furious about this. So if Congress ever catches up with what the American people actually believe on this issue, revenue-raising corporate tax reform will be right around the corner. I just think it's a case where there is now this disconnect between what Congress is hearing from corporate lobbyists and what the public is saying.
That was Matthew Gardner, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. To access a copy of the Offshore Shell Games 2015 report and related analysis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Bowel movements in prison will never be the same. Early September, administrators here at Warren Correctional Institution hired private contractors to install timers on the flushing mechanisms on prison toilets. The contractors came cell to cell, and we now have those big steel boxes the size of microwaves with a kind of raised steel button of sorts the size of a half dollar. That's what you press to flush the toilet. I'm not making this up. I swear I'm not. So this is how the timer works. You get one flush every 5 minutes. If you hit the flush button a second time before the 5 minutes expire, the toilet will flush, but you cannot flush the toilet for another hour. Essentially, if you flush twice in somewhat rapid succession, you get an hour-long penalty. This may not seem like a really big deal, but consider this is a level 3 facility. We have 2 prisoners to a cell. Aside from meals and recreation and in-pod activities, we're locked down 2 to a cell, roughly 12 to 14 hours a day. During those hours, frequently, the garbage that goes in has to come out. Typically, somebody using the toilet facility to dispose of solid waste will engage in a short checklist of courtesies to accommodate the other prisoners locked in the room. It's standard practice, for instance, to hang a sheet from the mirror across to the bed frame. Also, if anyone has any prayer oil, a prospective user will burn a small amount on the lamp to mask the smell. The final courtesy, of course, is frequent flushing in order to keep down the odor. Well, that's out. In irony of ironies, the Warren Correctional Commissary has been out of stock on prayer oil for months. If we didn't know better, we'd almost have to think that somewhere in offices with the shades pulled, some diabolical administrators have conspired to force the prisoner population to smell our cellmates' bowel movements. They're not trying to turn us into model citizens. They're trying to turn us into poop sniffers. Rather than produce smart cellars, their resolve to produce fart smellers. The rationales put forward for this offensive plumbing modification are superficially sensible, but are really bogus under any scrutiny. First, administrators claim that the toilet timers will prevent prisoners from using the toilet to flood the ranges. The timers certainly serve that purpose, but it's a solution to a non-problem. I've been locked up for 25 years. I've never been in population and seen a cell flood. That stuff that goes on in segregation or others or other lockdowns, and Warren now only has 2 3B level blocks out of 12. It makes no sense at all to expect water sport uprisings from 3A level prisoners. Also, keep in mind that anyone who really wants to flood the block can simply pop the sprinkler and release thousands of gallons of water under high pressure. The second reason for toilet timers is that administrators say they will save money. I'm skeptical. No telling what the contract costs to install these devices in every cell, or what the long-term cost will be to maintain them, or how much water they'll save now that they force prisoners to maintain trash cans full of water from the sink to act as an additional flush when poured into the toilet. My guess is, savings on the water bill will be negligible. The fact of the matter is this. The control freak, seeking the total and complete subjugation of every aspect of human life, come to the realization that prisoners' bowels were functioning without any regulation at all. A completely chaotic, willy-nilly situation. So high-arts and suits with stopwatches come to conclude that 5-minute timers would effectively regulate the operations of our lower intestines. The powerful elite have come to recognize that all of us at the bottom of the pyramid cannot be trusted with so much as the responsibility for exercising free will in the disposal of our own body weight. I bet the next application will be a helmet that yanks our jaws up and down, forcing us to chew each bite 32 times. Prison officials will, after all, have to take command of our entire digestive tract. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, forcibly silenced by prison officials whose home addresses are posted at blastblogs.noblogs.org. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243 Warren, 205, Warren, CI, PO Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Fiat Chrysler workers are voting Tuesday and Wednesday on the new tentative labor contract covering some 40,000 workers. It's a better contract than the one that these workers rejected, and it would be historically very unusual if this second vote didn't accept the agreement. Lower wage tier workers who have 4 years on the job will have the full traditional UAW wages by the end of this four-year deal. Lower tier workers with less seniority will see their hourly base wages rise by more than $8 an hour over the four-year contract. The UAW says this deal also includes a $5.3 billion investment in U.S. auto plants and a moratorium on outsourcing. Even if Fiat Chrysler workers approve this labor contract, the UAW still has to get agreements at both Ford and GM. Teamsters negotiators will try again to reach a new labor contract that the 6,000 union truckers hauling cars can approve. The car haulers overwhelmingly rejected the first tentative deal. The National Master Automobile Transporters Agreement covers thousands of car haulers in 39 locals. Workers voting down the first tentative contract felt it was a concessionary contract. In a video explaining the deal that was rejected, Teamsters leadership said it was a difficult negotiating environment and the proposed contract reflected marketplace realities. The union called it a modernized contract that was geared to rebuild union presence in the car hauling industry. In WIN's news commentary, our executive producer Frank Emspach deals with the problems in the U.S. retirement system and the very different solutions proposed by two presidential candidates.
The problems faced by retirees dependent on private pension plans made the news last week. Most Americans have little in the way of saving, so corporate irresponsibility places even more pressure on the Social Security system. Every day, corporations are demanding the privatization of some public service. The biggest prize of all is the privatization of Social Security. The biggest obstacle to privatizing Social Security is a well-run, well-funded Social Security system. Presidential candidates have addressed the issue of funding. For example, according to the New York Times, Governor Christie would reduce benefits, extend the retirement age, and eliminate some payroll taxes. Under his plan, the Social Security system would be insolvent by 2030. Senator Sanders would leave the retirement age alone, raise the cap on the payroll tax earnings to all earnings above $250,000 a year, and increase some benefits. His plan would result in Social Security being solvent through 2065. These are big differences and demand our attention. This is Frank Emspach for Workers Independent News.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant says her campaign is a working-class campaign funded by ordinary working people, while her opponent accepted a donation from the airline's CEO trying to eliminate the $15 an hour minimum wage victory approved by Seattle voters.
This race has attracted money from working people, not a penny of corporate donations, not a penny from big business executives. Just to give you an example, Brad Tilden lives in the district. He's the CEO of Alaska Airlines, who has filed lawsuit after lawsuit against the voter mandate for $15 an hour. That's a business executive. He has donated to my opponent's campaign. Our campaign funders are ordinary working people.
As Sawant works for what she calls housing justice, including rent control to protect working people from speculative developers, she points to the city's $15 minimum wage as an example of what working people can achieve when we unite.
For the first time, these last 2 years of my stay in the city council have shown that ordinary working people can get engaged, their voices can be heard. That is how we won the historic $15 an hour wage.
Los Angeles port trucker and Teamsters member Alex Paz says the recent White House Worker Voice Summit inspired worker activists like him to fight even harder for their union rights and for a voice in their workplaces.
The vibe out there was real positive. So it was really inspiring, and honestly, it gave me more fuel in the tank to keep pushing and get the middle class back to work and bring back America.
On Friday, the Independent Pilots Association representing UPS pilots will announce results of a strike authorization vote. UPS and its pilots started negotiations on a new labor contract in 2011. If the pilots approve a strike, the union can request a release from federal mediation, clearing the way for a possible pilots' strike at UPS if no agreement on a new contract is reached.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Each and every day, Workers Independent News puts the voices of workers and their unions on the radio news airwaves around the country. Voices like Jim Hoffa, president of the Teamsters Union.
Workers are getting their news from many, many sources today, whether it's from TV, website, social media, or radio broadcasts, such as Workers Independent News. News sources such as WIN, Workers Independent News, focus on labor union topics that are important to all working families.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio, live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Is the Canadian election campaign being manipulated? How is mainstream media and social media contributing to an exodus of political candidates mid-campaign? What does the response of the RCMP and Elections Canada to electoral irregularities tell us about the health of Canadian democracy? Does the telephone fraud executed during the 2011 election campaign constitute a state crime against democracy? And could a similar effort be underway in the current 2015 election? On this week's Global Research News Hour, with the 2015 Canadian federal election mere days away, we spend the hour examining the undermining of Canadian democracy in recent elections. We'll hear from media analyst and former electoral candidate Leslie Hughes about candidates being attacked for past statements during an election campaign and who benefits from this phenomenon. Then we'll hear from University of Guelph Emeritus Professor and author Michael Kiefer about the research he conducted on the role of telephone fraud in altering the results of the 2011 election and its implications for the current election. On this week's program, voter suppression in Canada, Conversations with Leslie Hughes and Michael Kiefer. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 16th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Google's Knowledge Graph, in case you didn't know, was the search engine's first attempt at becoming a purveyor of knowledge rather than just information. A smart search tool, if you will, designed to enhance the relevancy of search results by analyzing various facts, figures, and other data appropriate to a user's intended query. The Knowledge Vault builds upon this concept, but takes it another step further. By sorting through the actual content of websites to determine whether or not they fit the official narrative for the particular idea or concept presented, the Knowledge Vault will act as a type of knowledge gatekeeper in censoring out information and content deemed to be quote-unquote false. The Knowledge Vault promises to let Google answer questions like an oracle rather than a search engine, and even to turn a new lens on human history, wrote Hal Hodgson for New Scientist about the project. It is this latter statement that's deeply concerning, as Google now has the power to literally rewrite history by snubbing search content of which the powers that be disapprove, while approving only propaganda and other misinformation dubbed accurate. That comes from the article, Google Degenerates into Ministry of Truth. All knowledge must now be pre-approved by search algorithm, by Jonathan Benson, posted October 14th, originally appearing at Natural News. It seems that the EU is being greatly affected by the actions of Vladimir Putin in Syria. Suddenly, the EU president, Jean-Claude Juncker, is saying that the EU must not let the US dictate their relationship with Russia. He has demanded a normalization of relations and, indirectly, the end of sanctions. Some time ago, the U.S. Vice President Joe Biden made it clear that the U.S. had urged the EU to impose the sanctions. Juncker's big backflip is confirming the statement made by Biden. It's hard to discern what's really going on in Juncker's mind. As late as March, Juncker was demanding the establishment of an EU army, which was expressly directed against Russia. Such a European army would, quote, give Russia the impression that we are seriously intending to defend European Union's values, unquote, Juncker said word for word back then. That comes from the article, EU cannot go on fighting Russia. We cannot have our relationship towards Russia dictated by Washington, EU Commission President. By Russia Insider, posted October 14th, originally appearing at German Economic News. Why has Barack Obama airdropped 50 tons of ammunition into areas that moderate rebels in Syria supposedly control? Much of this ammunition will end up in the hands of those that the Russians are attempting to bomb into oblivion. And so to Russia, it appears that we are attempting to make their job much harder. And of course, the truth is that there aren't really any moderate rebels in Syria at all. At the end of the day, the U.S. supports just about anyone that wants to get rid of the Assad regime, and the Russians are working very hard to keep Assad in power. Just like the civil war in Ukraine, the conflict in Syria is in great danger of being transformed into a proxy war between the United States and Russia, and many fear that these conflicts could eventually be setting the stage for World War III. That comes from the article, Is Barack Obama Actually Trying to Start World War III? By Michael Snyder, posted October 15th, originally appearing in the Economic Collapse blog. From the moment the airliner was shot down, the U.S., NATO, and Ukraine have used the incident to indict Russia, and more specifically, Russian President Vladimir Putin, in the court of public opinion. It has used legal maneuvering and its well-oiled press to turn the investigation of the disaster into a witch hunt, with an inevitable outcome already eagerly determined to implicate Russia. The Western media has intentionally twisted the words of investigators to misrepresent evidence and preliminary and very cautious statements to portray them as definitive conclusions to establish Russia's guilt. Considering the lengths the U.S. and its allies have gone through to deceive the world regarding their crimes against the state of Syria, and considering the gain they have already wrought from exploiting the MH17 disaster, one must question the wisdom and reasoning of the West to go through such extraordinary lengths to at best portray Russia and Eastern Ukrainian fighters as guilty of accidentally shooting down an airliner flying over an active battlefield it should never have been directed over in the first place. What is more likely to play out later this month is that the exhausted credibility of the U.S. and its partners, both politically and across the media, will fail to sway public opinion or the facts on the ground in Ukraine in any shape, form, or way, regardless of the conclusions of the MH17 DSB and JIT investigations. That comes from the article, "The MH17 Malaysian Airlines Crash from Syria to Ukraine When Lying Catches Up," by Olson Gunnar, posted October 14th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Who exactly is going to get their hands on those 50 tons of munitions? The Russian Defense Ministry has reported that, quote, Russian airstrikes resulted in the elimination of the majority of ISIS ammunition, heavy vehicles, and equipment, unquote. This joins numerous other positive reports on the Russian intervention, where we hear 40% of the terrorists' infrastructure has been eliminated and the launch of cruise missiles caused an exodus among the ranks of ISIS. Despite canceling their rebel training program, the U.S. has now airdropped 50 tons of ammunition for small arms along with grenades into the ISIS hotbed of northern Syria. That comes from the article, U.S. airdrops 50 tons of ammo to rebels after ISIS loses most supplies in Russian airstrikes, by Stuart Hooper, posted October 15th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Well, the longest election campaign in modern Canadian history is about to come to an end. The campaign has been remarkable for its use of wedge issues and identity politics. Issues such as whether or not Muslim women should wear face coverings at citizenship ceremonies have strangely emerged as dominant election narratives, while questions surrounding sustainable health care, pensions, sustainable environment, and impacts of the recently agreed-to Trans-Pacific Partnership remain under-examined. What's more, there's been a rash of candidates ejected from their respective parties in the wake of revelations of past statements they've made on social and other media that could potentially prove embarrassing to the party leaders. Do these developments pose a challenge to our traditional democratic practices? Leslie Hughes is an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, media trainer, speaker, and humorist based in Winnipeg. She ran as a Liberal candidate in the North Winnipeg constituency of Kildonan and St. Paul. When she was asked to step down after an anonymous blogger posted an article of hers written in 2002 suggesting U.S. and Israeli foreknowledge of the 9/11 terror attacks, thus resulting in her being branded an anti-Semitic 9/11 conspiracy theorist. Leslie Hughes joins us now. She is also the author of an upcoming book detailing her experiences in that campaign. So, Leslie Hughes, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
Okay, so I was wondering if you could just maybe very, very briefly expand a little bit on what I've just said about your own candidacy and the circumstances under which you were ejected.
Well, as you put it, an anonymous blogger labeled me a conspiracy fool, a truther, which of course is a very controversial thing to say about anyone, and probably most importantly, anti-Semitic. And this blogger was anonymous, and those claims were completely unchallenged, completely unchallenged. And they went on to disqualify me as a candidate in the election of 2008. So I was watching with great interest how the numbers of people in this election of 2015 have been steadily rising. I think my last count was 22, but that might be out of date.
And just to clarify, did you ever have an opportunity, or did you feel that you had an opportunity to respond to the allegation before you were effectively dumped?
Oh, no. No, it all happened so quickly and without notice, really, that it was over before it started, really. I no, there was nobody actually spoke to me about what had gone on.
How did you find out that you were being ejected?
I found out in a media scrum just out. Yes, I know. Imagine the delight. I was filming and for a little sort of video biography on my election website, and a huge little group of reporters came out waving a piece of paper, which turned out to be my dismissal as a candidate. I had no idea that was coming. So it was all captured on radio and television, which is a very unusual experience, to say the least.
Now, as I remember, we're seeing a lot of candidates in this 2015 election, you know, experiencing the same thing. I mean, did you know back in 2008 you were kind of at the ground floor of a new phenomenon?
No, I didn't. Actually, there were too many other disastrous things to think about. But clearly, looking back, that was the case, because the claim was anonymous. It was an unaccountable claim. It was not examined. Achieved the job of eliminating me as a candidate very successfully. Like, I was over in no time. So what we've been seeing in 2015 is a lot more of the same, except that now I think it's probably a more popular approach. I think it has now become an established tactic in an election campaign, whereas previously I don't think people really recognized the power of what that could do.
Oh, okay. Maybe a kind of, your situation may have been like a kind of a dress rehearsal of sorts.
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting you talk about it as a tactic. What are some of the characteristics of that? I mean, assuming this is an apt description, what are some of the characteristics of this tactic?
Well, I think it's important to know that not only does this serve to the kinds of claims that are made against candidates, not only do they serve to humiliate the candidate and the candidate's party, or to expose that the candidate's party will not stand up for the candidate and therefore has no principles. It's a total lose-lose situation. But I think it's important to know that in some cases, the timing of these things is very important. The ideal time to squash a candidate is when it's too late to nominate another one. That whole nomination process takes time and organization. And so you want to do this at exactly the right time so that you eliminate the competition. You can imagine how appealing that would be to party strategists. And that was the case for me in my riding. Approximately 75,000 voters went without a Liberal candidate because it was just too late. Now that, imagine. And all of this costs no money, Michael. Think about that. Costs no money. It is so cost efficient. It's laughable.
I wanted to read another case study. This is someone from the 2015 election. He was running in the riding of Charleswood, St. James, Assiniboia. His name was Stefan Jonasson. He was running for the NDP. And he was essentially booted out because he compared the beliefs of the Haredim, an orthodox branch of Judaism, to the Taliban with regards to the treatment of women. And, I mean, even some Jewish leaders have said that that's not an irresponsible thing to say. However, the candidate in an interview with CBC said that his comments were taken out of context by the True North Times, a website that has promised to expose controversial comments by 9 politicians in 9 days. So, Leslie, I guess my question is, what do you think that this episode and yours and others says about this phenomenon and its potentially corrosive impact on democracy?
Well, for one thing, it's much, much wider than simply causing a lot of pain to individuals and their families, right? Because this kind of public shaming sort of goes back to the tar and feathering in the public square, right, where all kinds of observers get to enjoy the process. So, but it goes much, much, much deeper than that. I think it goes to the heart of the democratic process, because imagine yourself interested in politics, wanting to make a contribution, being qualified to do that, and being prepared to take the risks and make the sacrifices that it requires, and there are many. And then you see another person who is completely trashed. How? What could we possibly expect that to do to the political process except to diminish it and to weaken it? So I think that people who enjoy seeing the disintegration of democracy particularly enjoy the whole candidate shaming game. But I think that it's so toxic and so dangerous, and the candidate that you just referred to was quite correct, that something has got to be done to qualify and expose how this really, really works.
Yeah, I know that I've heard about how there is a strategy involved with what they call the attack ads. You know, it turns people off to the point where they don't vote at all, and that will often favor the people that are in power that are looking
the
incumbents. And I'm wondering if this is a sort of a parallel situation here in terms of discouraging participation,
you're suggesting
both voters and candidates.
That this could be one of the methods in voter repression. Right?
I suppose, yes.
Yeah, I would say that is correct. I don't think that is too an extreme an observation at all.
And at the end of this process, I mean, what kind of a crew of candidates will emerge if they know that they're going to be submitted to this kind of scrutiny? I mean, but not just scrutiny, but, in some sense, unfair scrutiny. They're not going to have a chance to clarify, well, this is what I meant, or this was what the context was.
Well, fair scrutiny is one thing, right? But you have to recall that many of us who are perfectly decent people have said stupid things we wish that we hadn't said, things in frustration, things in anger, things in immaturity. All of these imperfections do not necessarily mean that a person would not be a truly effective politician. As some of these revelations about character, for example, go back years and years. And you will often hear this from mature voters. They say, oh, thank God that I didn't grow up in the era of the social media, because I could have been labeled forever. When I think about things that I might have said and done that do not represent me, the evolving, the present me in any way, it's just a stunning tactic overall.
Could you talk to that whole aspect of social media, which has the ability to capture and preserve and distribute and disseminate these sorts of, inconvenient quotes and whatnot, and while at the same time not having that same, obligations that you would find from the more established media.
Well, you mentioned the established media, and I have to say that the social media reflects the worst practices of mainstream media. It's a mainstream media error writ large. And for example, the mainstream media is not really accountable. It's accountable to anybody who has a lot of money and time and patience. But for the average person, there is no accountability in mainstream media. And that is certainly the case in social media, where most people are anonymous and they're not prepared to own their opinions, to live up to them, or to defend them. Social media has picked up also the worst of the dysfunctional story. In mainstream media, the dysfunctional story is a story that doesn't really accomplish anything for the community. It's just meant to attract and divide. And often that's part of making money, right? You run a sensational story and you worry about the effects later because there may not be any. And social media does this superbly well, right? So you have the anonymity, you have your dysfunctional story. And I think also this is a perfect breeding ground for the half-truth, for given a lack of context and a lack of fact, it's so easy to conflate things, to conflate the 9/11 truth movement with anti-Semitism, for example, which I think is an argument that has been destroyed many times but continues to frighten people. Okay? So I think that all of these things need to be considered. Also, it's interesting to remember what John Ronson has said about the world of social media. He has written a very provocative and successful book recently called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, in which he points out that social media, which began as a democratizing environment where people could skip all the institutions and they could talk to each other honestly about things, make honest proposals about honest solutions to honest problems and so on, that whereas that may have been the beginning, what we have now, according to Ronson, and he is a sociologist who's done the homework, is a social media environment that is the equivalent of an angry child with poor impulse control, so that you never know when it's going to turn on you, and you are no match for it in any case, in any circumstance.
You have no control.
No, and he points out, how easy it is for good people to make mistakes on social media, because it's wonderful to be part of a crowd, because you get the reward of belonging for behaving as badly as everybody else. But you're not thinking about that. You're thinking about how nice it is to be part of a huge crowd of people, all of whom approve of you because you approve of them. Actually, he quoted, I think it was Voltaire, when he said, he also pointed out, that a single snowflake never takes responsibility for the avalanche, right? And that's what we become on social media. So it's really unfortunate that this has become such a powerful and negative force in the electoral process.
Yeah, I mean, I find social media quite frustrating, actually, because you can see that sort of avalanche of facts or comments or whatever out there. And I mean, here I am trying to verify any of this stuff, and by the time I have, it's already passed and I've been scooped.
It's too late.
So yeah. That begs the question, since we see social media now embedded in mainstream media and mainstream media forced to kind of accommodate this, what is the impact on mainstream media coverage of our elections?
Oh, it's totally downhill. Speaking of avalanches, it is totally downhill. And I was going to give you just a quick example from my own experience, in that when my case was resolved – and I sent out press releases and an electronic press kit explaining the history of the story and how it had turned out. A local CBC newsroom, told the story incorrectly. It was just had to be a very, very bad, unusual day at the CBC. This was a shock to me. And they reported the outcome of my case inaccurately, saying that I had not settled with all three of the people I had sued, which I had, but that I had settled with only one. And they forgot to mention completely that I had been cleared of the charges. Well, this story then lost its impact completely. Who's interested in a five-year-old story where one partner has settled? Nobody. This caused a panic in a number of people who were familiar with my case. Many people were calling me to inform me about this, and the follow-up calls revealed that whoever was on the case was just new, inexperienced, and didn't understand the importance of having a legal document, which was attached to the press release. The legal document wasn't there. Here's the thing, though. Yahoo News picked the story up, and by the time we knew that it was the wrong story, it was all over the internet. It was impossible to correct. So the impact of the victory was completely lost. You can, and this is as a result of the social media feeding on mainstream news. Mainstream news also feeds on social media in exactly the same way. Inaccuracies are just rushed into print or broadcast. Isn't that amazing? Mm. It's really difficult to believe that this has happened. Here's what I'm hoping will happen, Michael. I'm hoping that some very, very prestigious, serious media platform will examine all of the discarded candidates in Canada in 2015, all of them, to find out exactly how accurate they were, what were the half-truths that came out of it, what was the impact of all of this in the riding and on the individual candidates. And I think that you'll find that this is a very systemic, strategic thing to do, that people are paid to do this smear kind of work, and that there are sites like possibly True North Times, about whom we need to know more. We always need to know who's funding a source. And in many cases, anonymous bloggers are able to do their work as a result of funding, and that is never disclosed. So I am really hoping that this will become a serious journalistic project in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, Leslie Hughes, I want to thank you very much for sharing those insights with us. I guess you're going to be looking to see with some anticipation about the results of this election.
I'll be watching. Indeed, I will.
Okay. Leslie Hughes is the author of the upcoming book, The Naked Canadian, A Dead Candidate's Report. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Michael Kiefer is a University of Guelph Emeritus Professor of Literary Studies. He's the author of Anti-Semitism, Real and Imagined, Responses to the Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism, as well as an upcoming book that is tentatively called Sabotaging Democracy, Robocall Vote Suppression in Canada's May 2nd, 2011 Election. Professor Kiefer joins us from his home in Toronto. So, Professor Kiefer, you've been writing an essay, a multi-part essay that's been appearing in the Rabble blog, and it essentially details some of the elements of what you believe to have been essentially an interfered with or even a stolen election in 2011. I was wondering if you might want to just quickly outline for our audience some of the main points that you're making that convinces you that was, in fact, a stolen election.
Yes, I'll do that. The first thing to say is that we've been very badly served by the Canadian corporate media. There's been good investigative journalism by a handful of reporters, but the media response on the whole to what happened has demonstrated, I think, a kind of tragicomic level of political immaturity in this country. We were made the victims in 2011 of what I would call a state crime against democracy. That's not an original term at all. In other words, the evidence points very strongly and unambiguously to the Conservative Party of Canada as the organizer of a nationwide electoral fraud, vote suppression fraud by telephone, a campaign that began during the 2011 election with harassment calls that were designed to irritate voters, that deceptively pretended to come, in most cases, from the Liberal Party, so they were intended to delegitimize and damage the Liberal Party in the eyes of voters. Those calls were then followed in the last days of the election and on election day by misinformation calls, some of them live, some of them automated or robocalls. The robocalls usually pretended to come from Elections Canada and to inform voters with regret, with apologies for the inconvenience, that their polling station had been changed. The idea being to misdirect people to faraway places in the hope that they would be too exhausted, too tired, too frustrated to actually get around to voting. Now, one of the ways the media let us down was by representing what happened as though it were simply a matter of pranksters or crank calls. Terms like that surfaced regularly in media reports, both at the time and more recently. We had reports of fraudulent telephone calls coming into Elections Canada from 261 of Canada's 308 ridings. Very unevenly distributed. I mean, there were only a few calls, it would seem, in some ridings, and there were torrents. There were tens of thousands of calls in others. But that alone is a kind of starting indication of something that was obviously nationally organized. It couldn't be an accident that people used the same kinds of techniques across the country in harassment telephone calls, and that they used nearly identical scripts for the misinformation calls. In other words, this was nationally organized, and the scale of it was huge as well. We don't have evidence that's nearly as good as one would like to have, but what evidence we have from surveys made by two respected polling companies indicates that rather more than 1.1 million Canadians received fraudulent telephone calls during that election. Now, one of the things we know with a high degree of probability is that the calls were targeted, and the evidence points to the use of the Constituency Information Management System of the Conservative Party, the CIMS database, as the tool by which calls were targeted to principally to opposition voters, so that they were deliberately setting out with the harassment calls to damage the reputation of opposition parties, and with the misinformation calls to suppress the vote of opposition parties more directly. Now, I think that's the kind of central part of what we need to know about what happened. We need to know that the scale of this was huge. If you think about it, spreading those calls, if they were spread evenly over the 261 ridings, which they weren't, That would mean every one of those ridings received a couple of thousand of harassment calls and at least a couple of thousand of misinformation calls targeted to opposition voters. We know that the calls actually focused on about on less than three dozen ridings, probably less than 30 ridings, including ridings that were known in advance of the election to be swing ridings. Now, as to evidence that it made a difference, there are a couple of studies that have a bearing on this. One by based on survey evidence from ECOS Research, which indicated an effect of on average in the ridings that were most intensely targeted, 1.5% vote suppression effect. Doesn't sound like much, but if you think of these ridings as being very often targeted swing ridings, a drop in 1.5% in opposition party voting can be more than enough to swing the results. Another study by Simon Fraser University economist Anke Kessler, using a completely different methodology, found that in the some two dozen ridings that were most affected by the fraudulent telephone calls, there was a vote suppression effect of approximately 2,000 voters. That's a slightly larger effect than the ECOS survey found. Once again, it's more than enough to swing the results in many ridings. And without going into detail, if you think that in the last election, the conservative majority was based on 14 ridings in which the total, this sort of aggregate winning vote came to only 6,200 odd votes. We're looking at a situation in which it didn't take all that much to swing the results, to make the difference between re-election with a minority government and re-election as a majority government, re-election with a majority in parliament, which gives a prime minister who wants to be a tyrant enormous power. So that's the kind of central evidence, I think.
Now, I know that Elections Canada has a mandate to monitor the compliance with electoral legislation. When looking at not only at the 2011 election, but even the previous election, do you see any indications that Elections Canada may be falling short of its mandates and its responsibilities?
Yeah, well, one of the very first things the Conservatives did in their Accountability Act was to reduce the enforcement powers of Elections Canada, and they've reduced those powers much more significantly with the so-called Fair Elections Act of 2014. Elections Canada has done a poor job of enforcing the Canada Elections Act. In 2008, in what's now Elizabeth May's riding, I hope it remains her riding, of Saanich Gulf Islands in British Columbia,
That's the Green Party
riding
leader.
That's
the Green Party leader.
That's the Green Party, yes. Yeah. Yes. I think she's a very effective parliamentarian and contributes significantly to the kind mm-hmm. of level of political discourse in this country. But in 2008, the riding was held by then Minister of Natural Resources, Gary Lunn. And he was in danger of getting defeated when, shortly before the election, the NDP candidate had to withdraw, which meant, because it was so close to the election, that his name remained on the ballot. But it also meant that the Liberal candidate had a strong chance of winning the kind of homeless votes of NDP supporters in the riding. Now, in the previous election, the NDP had actually had slightly more votes than the Liberal candidate. It's very much a kind of three-way split between Conservatives, Liberals, and NDP in that riding during the last decade. Now, what happened is that the riding was flooded on the day before the election with robocalls urging people to vote for the NDP candidate. And these calls had a spoofed callback number. They pretended to come from the NDP Riding Association. There's polling evidence that before those calls, less than 1% of voters in Saanich Gulf Islands intended to vote NDP. In other words, people knew that they had no candidate. Most people did. There were only a few who remained kind of resolutely uninformed. But the robocall had a significant effect. 5.7% of the voters in that riding voted for a non-candidate. They voted NDP, basically flushing their votes down the toilet. So 4.7% of the electorate was deceived by those robocalls. And if you take the NDP vote in the preceding election of 2006 as a kind of marker of that party's support, something like 18% of NDP voters were deceived by the robocalls into basically wasting their vote. Now, the interesting thing about that, apart from what it demonstrates about the potential power of telephone fraud victimizing a public that hasn't previously been exposed to it, the interesting thing is that the RCMP refused to take any action. They said no law had been broken, which was, of course, completely false. It's against the criminal code to carry out fraud by telephone or to impersonate people by telephone. And Elections Canada said, we can't find out who did it, and we can't find anybody who was actually deceived by these calls, which is a complete confession of investigative incompetence. And they then said impudently that they did not believe that any law had been broken, which is a pretty flagrant falsehood. Now, what that told the people who carried out that fraud, obviously supporters of Gary Lunn, quite probably agents of the Conservative Party, what that told them is that they could get away scot-free with serious electoral fraud. And I think that may have incited the Conservatives to the national effort that they put into electoral fraud in 2011.
You brought up the RCMP's role just now in not investigating, saying there was no indications of criminality. But you, as you pointed out in your series of essays, and as we've pointed out on this news show, the RCMP have had it seems to be interfering with regular government processes, not just elections, but whether we're talking about the 2006, where they decided to start investigating the Liberal finance minister at a critical moment in the campaign.
And yes, that had a decisive impact on that election, and is one sign of serious corruption in the RCMP, because they announced an investigation not merely of Ralph Goodale's office, but of Ralph Goodale himself. And this was the cabinet minister who, above all others, in that faltering Liberal government, who had the reputation for being a straight arrow, for being decent and honest and above board. And the effect of that was very marked. In Ontario, the polls showed a swing from an 18% Liberal lead to a 6% Conservative lead. So I think it's arguable that that was a decisive factor in that election. Perhaps along with the In-N-Out scandal that the Conservatives perpetrated, which was a clear example of financing fraud in an election.
You've also got the issue of like when they have the terror arrests, for example, and then they just tend to have these conferences where they just announce it, and it always seems to be at a critical time when there's some legislation being passed. I've commented on this show, for example, how the day before the Commons vote on Bill C-51, we saw a leak of information from the RCMP about how there were going to be a terror attack against the West Edmonton Mall, and that was running all day long. And I mean, it seems like you've got a bit of a pattern there. I mean, is it taking things a little bit too far to suggest that maybe there's some kind of RCMP government collusion happening?
No, I think it's transparently clear that there is a corrupt engagement in Canadian politics on the part of the RCMP. And it's clear that the RCMP is corrupt in other ways as well. I mean, back in, I think it was 2007, there was that never properly investigated scandal involving their pension fund. Senior RCMP officers appear to have looted the RCMP pension fund and got away with it. So it's a seriously corrupt organization. And I think one can probably suggest that its corruption spreads in various directions and that the blame for that corruption should be spread wider than just within the senior ranks of the RCMP. I mean, if you think that after Canada in 2004 helped to overthrow the democratic government of Haiti, the RCMP took on responsibility for training the Haitian National Police. And one then saw clear evidence that the Haitian National Police was running death squads who were murdering people with sniper fire in pro-democracy demonstrations in Port-au-Prince and elsewhere. So the RCMP was in effect responsible for that kind of criminality. And I think when you put a national police force into that sort of situation and allow or encourage them to participate in that kind of criminality, you're asking for trouble at home.
Mm. Now, you framed all of this, this series of essays you've written or are writing, because it still hasn't all come out yet, in the under the umbrella of state crimes against democracy, as I see it, or at least that's how you framed it in an earlier.
Yes, in an essay I published at Global Research. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, have you been able to ascertain any patterns throughout, through this? Series of electoral fraud, like when you're talking about state crimes against democracy, which can encompass a lot of different methods. What are the familiar patterns that you're seeing here that you've seen in other instances in the United States, for example?
Well, there's an excellent book by an American political scientist, Lance DeHaven Smith, who teaches in the Florida university system. Conspiracy Theory in America, University of Texas Press, published a couple of years ago. And conspiracy theory is, of course, the term that is used to immobilize critical discourse directed toward an exploration of state crimes against democracy. So he's concerned to advance the term state crimes against democracy in opposition to that kind of silencing rhetoric. He points out that state crimes against democracy in the United States have tended very much to be clustered around elections, whether it's assassinations or other kinds of criminality. They're very often aimed at working the levers of power through the manipulation of the electoral system, either by getting rid of people who are threatening candidates to the interests of the perpetrators of this kind of crime, or by fraudulently altering the results of the system, or by fraudulently suppressing the vote of typically minority voters, Hispanic voters, black voters. I think one of the central things about state crimes against democracy is that that's what they tend to focus on. In other words, one of the central features of representative democracies, the electoral system.
Now, is this then a question of one corrupt party then, or is there are there other external influences involved, U.S.-based or elsewhere?
Well, in the United States, I mean, the two major parties are, of course, great sort of coalition umbrellas of disparate interests, but they do, I mean, one can call them wings of the same bloody bird, if you like, but they do have significant differences in orientation in at least some respects. And one of the obvious things to say about the Republican Party with its interest in policies that tend to be in the interests of the well-to-do and to disfavor the interests of working people is that they're acutely aware that because of their policy orientations, they're never going to achieve majority support. In other words, they have a kind of inbuilt pressure on them to fiddle and corrupt the electoral system. And that's what they've been very vigorously doing for at least the last quarter century. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there has been... I mean, there's actually very good evidence that the American presidential elections in particular have been systematically fiddled and corrupted since the 1980s.
Okay. Well, Professor Kiefer, I'm just wondering then what your thoughts are about recent reports from the last round of advance voting. Reports about pre-marked ballots, where there was the Elections Canada official, I think his name was John Enright, a spokesman said that this was like a printing error and just happened to get a little bit of ink onto one of the spaces next to the names of certain candidates, but basically these were essentially considered spoiled ballots, and if someone tried to vote with one of those, it would be considered spoiled. You know, I'm thinking of this as maybe Canada's hanging Chad scenario. What are your thoughts? Is it over the top to suggest that maybe this is the next round of fraudulent behavior?
No, I don't think so, because, I mean, I think that at the very least, there is evident moral corruption within Elections Canada. If one looks at the report with which the Commissioner of Canada Elections, Yves Côté, who is the official responsible within Elections Canada for enforcing the Canada Elections Act, the report in April 2014 with which he closed down his investigation of electoral fraud in the 2011 election. Summary Investigation Report on Robocalls was the title of it. He claims, for example, that his investigators were unable to find evidence of criminal intention, and therefore there's no point carrying out a prosecution because if there's no evidence of intention, then you can't convict any, you can't hope to convict anybody under the Canada Elections Act. Now, the evidence in his own report flagrantly contradicts that conclusion in multiple ways. One of the most obvious ones being simply this. Elections Canada collected 2,448 complaints about fraudulent telephone calls. They actually received far more complaints, but they weren't very assiduous in keeping records until at least the middle of 2012. 2,448 complaints, evenly divided, 51% to 49%, between complaints over harassment calls and complaints over polling station misinformation calls. Now, here's the surprising thing. 2,448 complaints, but 1,726 complainants. That's a bit of a surprise. You think about it, what that means, unambiguously, is that 42% of the people who received or who complained about fraudulent phone calls received both kinds of calls.
Mm.
Now, ask any statistician, ask anyone who's you know taken a one semester first year course on statistics. That's evidence of intention. That's evidence that many of the people who were targeted for one kind of call were being targeted for both kinds of calls. And there's a great deal more within the report that similarly shows up the how fatuous the claims made by the Commissioner of Canada Elections were. So that tells one that in a very senior position in that organization, you have somebody who is actively not interested in doing his duty and enforcing the law. Should it be any surprise then that there might be people elsewhere in the organization who are engaged in lesser forms of, let's call it, moral corruption? I think not.
Mm. Professor Kiefer, you've brought forward some very provocative points in your series of essays and over the course of this conversation. I want to thank you very much for sharing these very important points with us. And as we are in the lead up to Election Day as we record this conversation, but perhaps we can have a bit of a look back in the next week or two just to see, well, what happened and what it means.
Yes, that's always interesting to do a bit of a postmortem and see whether any new forms of corruption have manifested themselves.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
We've been speaking with University of Guelph Emeritus Professor of Literary Studies Michael Kiefer. Professor Kiefer's analysis of fraud in the 2011 election is available at rabble.ca and on the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.